Martin Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S, of 1109 Valencia Drive, Bakersfield, California. The interview was done for the California State College, Bakersfield, California Odyssey Project by Judith Gannon on February the 23rd, 1981. Okay, Mrs. Holmes, why don't we start out by your telling me a little bit about your childhood in Oklahoma?
Well, the first thing that I can remember is that we lived in Shakota when I was about between 5 and 6, and my father had a shoe shop there, and he didn't only repair shoes, he made shoes. And we also had a second-handed store in it, and we handled new stuff also. But my father decided that he wasn't making enough money, and so he went into farming, and he found out later that he was doing very well in the shoe shop there. But we started farming, and we started, I guess, with cotton, corn, milo, maize, sugar cane, and of course our gardens on the side. And I can remember working in the field with my father. I started picking cotton in a little salt sack. I went from that to a flour sack, and from that to a potato sack, which they call gunny sacks here. They were tow sacks there. And then from that to a cotton sack as we grew. And there were 7 of us children. We all had to work hard to help support the family. My mother was ill from the time I could remember with cancer. And that was way back there before. I can't even remember when she got it. She didn't die till 45. But anyhow, we worked in Oklahoma till I grew up, and then I got married at the age of 16. I didn't finish school because we had to work when there was work to be done. The only time we could go to school when there wasn't anything on the farm to do, and it wasn't because my father didn't want us to have education. It was because that it just taken us all to do the work. We farmed from 100 to 150 acres, and there's no one man could do that, and we worked our horses. My sister and I, we would plow with my daddy when the boys, sometimes after they got bigger, they left home and they went other places to find work, and so it left my sister and I, older than myself, and we would help my daddy do the plowing. We would plow the crops, we would help lay them by. Laying them by means the last plowing that they would get before the harvesting time. And we worked very hard, and as I said, I growed up, and then I got married at the age of 16. I began to have children.
Before we go on to your married life, tell me a little bit about your life on the farm. As far as, did you have social life, or what, and what was that like?
Yes, we had social life. My folks were very religious, and we attended church a lot. We went to all kinds of functions in that line. We weren't allowed to go anywhere else. I think that's why my brothers left home. I felt like it at times, but I didn't. But we were a happy family, and did you want me to tell what that we done on the farm? Okay. We raised our farm. We harvested. We picked our cotton. We gathered our corn. We cut our cane. We made our sorghum molasses. All of that we milked. I have milked from 4 to 5 cows, in the morning and at night. Besides that, there was others milking. We always had milk and butter. There was one time we didn't, after that my father left the shoe shop and we went to farming. We like to starve to death that year. My uncle gave us corn to ground for meal, and another woman would give us the whey off of her milk. That's all we had for several, I'd say for 2 or 3 weeks. We all got real poor and thin, I should say. And I can remember when we would have something to eat, like cornbread, and somebody give us some sorghum molasses. My mother would say, take a little bite of the syrup and a big bite of the cornbread, and then you'll get full quicker. And we did have hard times. We suffered that year, but that's the only year that I can really remember going hungry. Now, there was times that we never had very much, but we had plenty of what we did have, which was mostly milk and bread. We ate cornbread lots of times for breakfast, and we usually always had biscuits. My mother made homemade biscuits, and we had biscuits and butter and syrup, but we took our eggs to town. There was a few times we had plenty of eggs, but we would pack our eggs in a tub in a cotton seed to keep them from breaking, because we went to town in wagons, and would have to take our, we also had separators. We would separate our cream, and we would take a big cream can full of cream to town on Saturday. That was our big day, was Saturday. And we'd take our eggs, and if my mother thought we weren't going to have enough to buy the main thing that we bought, we usually raised everything else, would be salt and sugar and baking powders and coffee. And my mother made sure she had her coffee. Peaberry was her brand, and you couldn't fool her. You could just try every way to give her some other coffee, and she always knew if it was Peaberry or not. But that was our staples, that, you know, because we raised about everything else. And if we was ever able to get a loaf of light bread, that was like dessert to us. My mother did have a friend that she'd got acquainted with when we had our shoe shop, and they had a grocery, restaurant. And she would sometimes save the bread heels for my mother in a flour sack. And my mother would get it on Saturday and bring it home. And us kids, we couldn't wait till she got home, because to us that was a big treat. We would get those heels, and she'd say, don't eat too many of them. Let's let them, make them last 2 or 3 days. And then she'd make bread puddings with them. And we thought we was just in hog heaven. And they were good. And anyway, going on, where am I?
Okay. You were, let's go back to, you had just mentioned that you married at 16, and let's start by telling me how you
okay.
met your husband.
All right. Well, I met him when I was, the first year I started school, I was 6, and we was going to a place, a school called Who'da Thought It? Who'da Thought It, Oklahoma. And I'll give you a little rerun on how it got that name. Years before I started school, there was it was rough in those days, and there was a lot of big old rough boys, and they'd whip every school teacher that would come in there. And so finally, there was a little woman about 5'2", and she weighed about 95 pounds, and she put in for the job teaching school there. Well, all the officials told her, said there isn't any way that you can teach school, because they whip every man and run him off. She says, I'll take the job. If you'll give it to me, I'll chance it. So they couldn't get another man, and so they put her in. Well, she rode a horse, to school, and she had a black a whip. And so the first day she was in school, well, she just took this whip and she wrapped it around her hand and she took it with her. And the first thing she told them, she said, now this was the story that my brothers and told me, because they was larger than I was, and they went, might have been some of them that helped run off the teachers, I don't know, because they was rough characters too. But anyway, they said that she stood up and she said that we will have, what's the word that you use for it, like respect in class? Anyway, she said, you will respect me, you will respect this school, you will respect the people, the students that come here, and there will be, it'll not be this and there'll not be that. You'll do this and you won't do that. And so one of the boys stood up and he said, what makes you think that you can keep order here? We've whipped and run off every school teacher that's been here for the last 5 years. She says, I will be here when you're all gone. And so they begin to make a fuss, you know, and start some trouble and this, that, and t'other. And she just unwrapped this whip from her hand, and she just, oh, they said plumb across the school, she just give a whip of that and just took a hunk out of one of these boys. And she taught them respect, and they learned to love her, and that's how it got its name, Who Would Have Thought It? That's, and so they named the school Who Would Have Thought It instead of Who Would Have Thought It. It was Who Thought It. So that was our school. And so I started going there. And my husband was, let's see, 4 years older than I. He wasn't my husband then. But he was 4 years older than myself. And so I kind of got a crush on him. And he got one on me. The first year that I went to school, I was six. And so our little love affair started then. And so he would, boys, the main thing then was shooting marbles, they called it. And so he would play marbles, and he would hunt me up, I don't care where he was at, and he would, if he won a real pretty marble, and girls then wore, they didn't wear breeches and things to school, slacks, they wore dresses and long stockings. And all the little dresses had pockets in them. So he would run and give me this pretty marble, and I would put it in my pocket in time. I'd go home every evening, my dress would just be hanging down on one side, and because I'd have quite a few pretty marbles in it. And we left there after, let's see, that went on that whole year, and we was getting pretty close, you know, wasn't nothing serious, but just we liked each other real well. And he told me one time, I remember, he caught me out behind the step, and he told me, he said, I like you, Loy. And I said, I like you, too. And so that was our little love affair, the way it started. But anyway, I went to school that year, and perhaps the next year, it was the same the next year. And then we left and went to Kansas, and we harvested wheat that year. And I remember scribbling him a little note, and my sister liked his older brother. My sister older, 2 years older than me, liked his brother 2 years older than him, and we wound up marrying those boys. But anyway, we went to this wheat harvest out in Kansas, and my sister said, I'm going to write Monroe a letter. And I said, well, I want to write Russell one too. Well, I couldn't say anything, but I miss you and I like you. And we sent it to them, and they got it, and she sent it. And so then we was out there all summer, and then when we come home and started school in the fall, well, there he was, and man, he's all smiles. So we started the same old thing over again, him playing marbles and me taking them. And I remember one day, some boy had done something to me. I don't know what they'd pulled my hair. I had long black hair, and it plaited, two little pigtails on each side, ribbons on, and some boy had pulled my hair. And he was kindly a bully, And he jumped up on this stump, and he crowed like a rooster. And he said, anybody that hurts my sweetheart's going to get hurt. And he jumped off this stump, jumped onto this barn, and just beat the tar out of him. Well, let's see. Then we kept moving. People in Oklahoma, they would rent farms, and they would move around. And so we kind of got separated there for several years. But when I was 14, they moved over close to us. And the first thing he done, he said he always kind of kept tab on me where I was at. And but I was young and, you know, just out of sight, out of mind. And so he looked me up, and we started the same old thing over again. So we went to going together at 14, and at 16 we were married. And so that was in 1933, and by the time I was 18, I had two children. I had my first daughter February the 7th, 1934. I had another little daughter in 1935, November the 25th. And she was born on her father's birthday. My husband and I, when we got married that year, well, he made a sure crop. In fact, he had started making a sure crop with my father. We liked each other so well, we thought we'd just well to go ahead and get married. So we did, and we finished that sure crop that year with my father. We made a little, but not much, because things had really begun to get bad, and the drought was on, and hard times. We did move out to ourselves the next year, and which would have been 34, the year my daughter was born. And we farmed for ourselves, and our crop burned up. Our corn got 2 feet high and burnt to pieces in the field. And he cut this corn and just brought it in to feed what stock we had. We only had, let's see, we had 2 horses, I guess, and a cow. And then we had 3 hogs. He killed them 3 hogs, but due to the change in the weather, it was warmer, and we didn't cure it right, I guess, or something, but we lost, as hard as times was and as scarce as meat was, we lost those 3 hogs. So they spoiled. And so due to all the hard times and everything, we moved back in with my daddy because he was going to have to hunt work other places. So we moved north of Shakota, and he left me there. I had one baby, and he left me there, and he went to Casa Grande, Arizona to find work, which he did. He found work, and he sent for me, and I rode out with his boss and them that had come out to visit, and I met them in another town, and I went back with them. And we was there several months, and I became pregnant with my second child and was awfully ill. And the cotton was picked, and he was pulling bows, and I wanted to go home. I was homesick. It was the first time I'd ever really been away from my parents and hadn't seen them in so long, which was about 3 or 4 months. And I liked to die. I thought I'd been away 2 or 3 years. Well, he sent me home. And he remained in Casa Grande finding what work that he could. So my baby was born the 25th of November, which was on his birthday. And we left, she was 3 weeks old when we left there. In the same, let's see, it would have been in January. She was born in November, and we left 3 weeks after. And we was going into Texas to my mother's place, my mother's sister's place, to have Christmas. Anyway, we got there 2 or 3 days before Christmas. And So we stayed there through Christmas, and then we came on through Casa Grande and picked up my husband there. And so then we made our trip on to Imperial Valley. And when we got to Imperial Valley, well, we got a job picking peas.
Okay, before we get...
Okay.
Before we get into what happened in the Imperial Valley, a couple of things I'm wondering about. One was, did you have a midwife deliver your two daughters or what?
I had a doctor with both of my babies. I had a doctor and a nurse with the last one. I had just a doctor with my first one. I was in labor about 13 hours with her. She weighed 10 pounds, my first baby. I liked to die. And he didn't know much more than I knowed. But anyway, it was a bad time. And I think she cost me $13. And he worked that long for that much money. And then with my second baby, I had a chiropractic doctor, which I went to all during the time that I was carrying her. And some people may not believe in this, but if I was going to have a baby now, I would go to a chiropractic doctor. He would give me treatments. He kept my bones all limbered up and everything, and give me exercise to do every day. And I told him what a hard time I had with my first one, and he said, "You'll never have this with this baby." He said, "There isn't any use of any doctor ever being at a woman's house any longer than 5 hours." And he said, "I'll never be there in longer than 5 hours." So I was encouraged, and that's the truth. He was only there 4 hours, and he worked with me in a way that I've never heard of any doctor working with a woman. I'm not going to go into that unless you would want me to. And anyway, he delivered that baby, but he had a way of making you have your pains and then not when he felt like that you had wore yourself out, he could stop the pains. And he really did this. This was really something, and I've often thought about this, and I don't know why I didn't look up a doctor when I was going to have my last child. Of course, we just got out here, and we're so poor. At that time, I wouldn't have had money. Well, anyway, my second baby only cost me, the whole thing only cost me $15, the year's treatment and everything. So.
Okay, and the other question is, why did your husband choose Casa Grande, Arizona? How did he come to pick that place?
Well, my daddy had told him, we had friends there that my daddy and mother had years and years back, and they were there, and they wrote letters backwards and forth all the time, and they told them what good cotton they had there, and that there wasn't really that much of a difference in the change, you know, like depression and everything. It was hard times everywhere, even in California, to them that had been here, but to us it was paradise when we got here. But anyway, he chose Arizona because that he heard there was a lot of good cotton there, and he was a good cotton picker, and he was just willing to do anything to make a living to support his family.
Okay. So what prompted him to leave Casa Grande and go to the Imperial Valley?
Well, naturally, we came through, you know. And so he wanted to be with his family, and which was me and his two children. And so we went there, and he joined up with us, and he never had any car or anything. So
let me interrupt you just a second so I can understand.
Okay.
Then you went to the Imperial Valley with your mom and dad?
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Yeah.
And what made them choose the Imperial Valley?
Well, I don't really know. I think we came that way on account of the weather. It was in the winter. And of course, you just get stories backwards and forth, and they say it's warm there, and you won't freeze to death. And as we had nothing to live in, well, we thought we would come through there, and if needs be, well, we could just live in a tent. or something, you know, which we did. And so when we got there...
Just a second, back okay. up 1 second again. Okay. When your family decided that to move to California because the crops were so bad...
It was bad, yeah. Yes. It had really hit us there. And we was the ponds were dry. We hauled water in barrels from the ponds and creeks. The creeks dried up and the ponds began to dry up, and we'd take it in barrels to our farm, our lots, where our stock was. And we would just give them a little because the water was, unplentiful. We drew water out of the wells till the wells got so low that we just couldn't draw water anymore out of the wells for them. And it was just quickly diminishing everything. So my father said, I feel like that while that things is as well with us as it is. Now, we was poor, but not as poor as a lot of people. My daddy was a good manager. He was a hard worker, and he had always had a lot of cows, lots of stock, lots of horses, lots of hogs and things, and a lot of farming equipment. So he talked it over with my mother, and she said, well, I am willing. She never did want to leave Oklahoma, but she said, I'm willing. We got to do something. And so they advertised a sale and got an auctioneer, and we had a sale. And when we sold out everything we had, everything they'd worked for all of their lives, I think they had $1,400. And that was a lot of money mm-hmm. in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My daddy always had a truck of some kind, but he traded that truck in on another one, which was a 52... I've got that down here somewhere. It was a 52 or 42 old Chevy, two tons.
It must have been a 42 because, you know, it had to be older than that.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't start out here.
Well, okay. It was a 42.
No, it must have been even a 32.
I mean a 32. That's what it was. It's 32. I got it down here somewhere. It's a 32 Chevy, a two ton. Okay. My daddy was quite a mechanic, so he made sure that everything was up to par before we started. And we also heard that, the way we heard these things now, my sister had went on 2 or 3 months before just in we called them touring cars then. It was a one-seated car with a rumble seat, and believe me, there was my sister and her husband and her little girl and my brother and another woman and her girl went to California from Oklahoma. How many would that be? Let's say, yeah. And so this woman and her daughter rode in this rumble seat all the way to California, and she was quite an old woman then. And so they hit rain and everything, and they would put plastic up over them and hunker down in that. But anyway, they got all the details because they didn't try to take any bedding through or anything with them. So they would write back and tell us if we was coming what we had to do. And my mother and daddy both have been very precautious. We, as I say, got this car fixed up and everything. They told us they were checking for boll weevils, bed bugs, and all this stuff, which a lot of people in Oklahoma, it was plentiful. Almost everybody had bed bugs. And boll weevils covered the state of Oklahoma. So before they picked cotton and they took it to a mattress factory deal. And we had 3 brand new mattresses made, tagged, and they had been sterilized, everything. So we, my mother set them aside, and we wouldn't even sleep on them, feared that, they'd know, well, they'd been slept on, and we wanted to take our bedding through. My mother and I had worked all summer and up into the winter making new quilts. She even taken those, and though we never had no bed bugs, that was one thing she wouldn't have. She just would work day and night if any showed up. And sometimes they would, and you wouldn't even know where they come from. People would come with you and stay all night, and they'd even bring them in their clothes. But we made new cover, and she had them taken up to this place and had them sterilized, put in bags of some kind. I don't remember now just what they were. And we just slept under our old stuff. And by the way, we left that when we left.
Just a minute. The tape is just about ready to okay.
end, so. I think we were making covers and things. Anyway, we made our new quilts and we packed them. And then my mother bought new pillow ticking, and she covered our pillows. So everything that we left with was new. And we'd also heard how that they would check the trucks and things for boll weevils. And so my mother had the boys to take our old iron pot that we always boiled our clothes in, which that's the way we washed back there. I didn't get that in. We washed on a rub board, carried water. Usually our well water was hard. We'd carried water from the pond, and we would bucket after bucket, and we had lots of clothes, heavy clothes. And we washed on a rub board. We made our lye soap. We used lye soap. And we boiled our clothes. Everything was real pretty and white because we just boiled everything. Anyway, my mother, she had the boys to fill that pot up full of water, and she put, I think, a whole can of lye in it. And she said, told my father, she said, I'm gonna clean that truck bed till there'll be nothing. They won't make us unload everything when they see how clean it is. He said, oh, we'll have to unload everything anyhow. But she got up in there and she put this boiling, scalding hot lye water in this truck bed. And she washed every little crack and corner of that till it was bleached as white as a sheet. And so, and she wouldn't let nobody in there till we put our things in. And it was in the winter time. It took it a couple of days to dry. But it finally dried, and so when we left there, well, we loaded up everything in one truck. We did bring a lot of stuff. I don't know how we got that much stuff in there, but we did. There was, let's see, there was my father, my mother, my two brothers, my sister, myself, and my two children, and my nephew. Nine, is that right? About nine of us in that truck. Well, the two boys usually rode in the cab with my father, and when we would come to a hill, my brothers would stood on the fender with a big rock, and sometime that old truck would just chug, chug till it would stop. It'd get hot and stop, and the brakes weren't too good, I don't think, but the boys would jump out of the car and throw these big rocks under the wheel. We call them scotching the wheels. And so that's the way we'd get up these big hills. And I remember it was so scary. One time when we would hit high winds, my daddy built up the sides of the truck quite high, I guess 4 or 5 feet high. Then we put a tarpaulin over it. And to keep, because the rest of us, and they had the bed fixed to where that we could stay in the bed back there. Well, and my baby been quite little, and she got sick on the way, and I wasn't well when we left, and I got sick. And I was very sick, and my baby too, and we like to lost her. But when we would hit these high winds, it would almost blow that off. It would pop it against the bows. My father put bows up like they used a wagon and wagon, you know, and bows and an old wagon sheet. And we used them back there too when we'd go to church and go off to picnics and things, even burning up. But anyway, that would pop that against those bows till it would just almost run you crazy. All the way from Oklahoma to California, we heard this. One time, Coming through Arizona, do you need to stop me for anything? The wind caught it and blew it off. And it caught several of our things and blew it off. And my mother, my daddy, I don't know, he couldn't hear anything. And I remember one time she's trying to get him to stop, and he couldn't hear, and so she always wore high heels. She turned her heels as far as that glass in the back of the car, and she's like, kicked it out. And so finally he said to one of the boys, "What's she wanting?" And so they said, "She wants you to stop." So stop, and the boys had to jump out and go, I don't know how far back, and pick up several pieces of our clothing, which wasn't many. We didn't leave there with many. Anyway, where am I at?
You're on the trip, and you're living in the back of the truck with the tarpaulin over there.
Yes. Okay. We would camp at night, and we built little fires, and we'd do our cooking at night. And then we would take, we had a real clean wagon sheet. My daddy bought it new. And he would take that out. Now, that was before we got to the state line, and we was making sure that nothing was happening to those mattresses. And they would take this mattress out very carefully and put it on this white wagon sheet. And then my mother would have them to put the rest of the wagon sheet over it, and then they'd put their bedding on it. And my daddy and the two boys slept on that, and my mother and my sister and the three kids all slept in the other bed. We all just piled up together. And we made it. It was cold, and we didn't much mind. I don't know where we didn't much care, because we just stayed warm, that was all. But we traveled along, and when there was one place we come to, they called it on top of the world, and it was in Arizona somewhere, Globe Mountain. It was on Globe Mountain, but at that time they called it the top of the world. And my sister and them had wrote back out and told us about this awful, awful mountain. Well, when we was going up the mountain, my mother made my daddy stop. She says, "I'm not going to ride in this truck up that mountain." And so, because the roads was narrow, and though my daddy was in the road, the truck bed hung out over the canyons, and it looked like he was running off, and all we could do is just look outside that bed and look down in that canyon. My mother was screaming and hollering all the time, telling my daddy to get over. And there was places in the road where you would have to stop and back up and let people by, because it was just a little two-lane road, and bad at that. But I remember she made him stop, and she says, "Come on, Laura." And it's the funny thing, we left the kids in the car. My mother said, "We can't drag those kids up this mountain." And she says, "They'll never know it if they go off, Laura." But we started up the mountain, and we didn't know what walking up mountains was. And my daddy went on, and they was just chugging along. And our legs got so tired that we couldn't walk. And so she wore like a big hat. She always wore hats. And she took that hat off, and she's just waving it and waving it, getting my daddy stopped. So one of the boys looked back and sees and said, "Dad, I think Mama's wanting you to stop." So we crawled up in that car, and she said, "If we go off, we go off. That's all this day." But she looked and seen that he was really in the road, but the bed was hanging out over, And so we felt a little better. But anyway, one time she got so scared, she had one of these new quilts in her hand, the corner of it, and she literally twisted the corner of this quilt completely off. She was so frightened. And as I said, she was sick. She had this cancer in her eye at that time. And it was a nervous wreck. And I remember her saying, "If I ever get to California, I'll die there. I'll never leave." And she did. We got here, and she never did want
to go through that again.
She didn't want to go through that again. But I remember when we got on top of that mountain, we camped out, and we stayed all night there. And I remember taking something. We opened up something. We had these little can cutters. You stick in there and you'd work them up and down, and then you'd raise the four prongs, you know, of the can up and pour stuff out. And I had never seen a can cutter. And in fact, I think they had just started making them where you'd cut the can and it'd be smooth, you know. I went to take some bark cans out to this trash can, and I seen these smooth cans. Now, this sounds funny, but this is God's truth. And I come wagging back, I don't know how many of those cans, and I told my mother, I said, look here, somebody's throwed away these cups. I had never seen a smooth cut can before in my life. And come to find out, we made two or three trips, and I kept seeing these people go out there, and they're throwing these. And I told my mother, I said, well, them are cans. It's like I said, they've got something that's cutting them, you know, smooth that way. So I went in this store to ask her if they had can cutters that cut cans smooth like that. And she says, yes, they have just come out. And she showed me one. Well, anyway, I had my little baby with me. And they owned this store, and they had never been able to have children. They were about, at this time, they were in their 30s. And I was, I guess, 18 at this time, yeah. So she began to beg me for my baby and wanting me to let her adopt it. And she says, we will set you folks up well, and told me what they would do for us, or she'd give me so much money if I would let her adopt my baby. I did have a real pretty baby, and she said, honey, you're so young, and she said, you're on your way to California, and you never know what you're going to run into there, and she says, we're settled, established, we're not wealthy, but we're well-heeled, and she says, I can give this baby a good life. And she'll have anything in the world she wants. She'll inherit everything my husband and I have. And would you consider this? I said, I wouldn't give my baby up to anybody. I said, I may not have much, and I may not ever have anything, but I said, nobody will ever get my baby. I said, don't you realize? I love my baby. She said, well, we would love it too. And she really put up a hard luck story, but I mean, there was never even a thought in my mind that I would let that baby go. So I went back out to camp, and I told my mother, I never will forget, she just got up and she walked out to that store, and she said, my mother was half Cherokee Indian, and she had long black hair and green eyes, and her eyes literally snapped when she got mad. And even though she's very religious, she's capable of getting mad. She went in that store and she said, my daughter told me that you wanted to adopt the baby. And she says, yes, I'd like very much to. She says, I want to tell you something. She says, we're not rich people. But we lived pretty good in Oklahoma till this drought hit. We're on our way to California to do better. And she says, I want you to know we're not the kind of people that give away our children. I've had seven of my own. I've seen harder times than this when I lived in Arkansas. And she said, that's before I was born. And she says, I never one time thought about giving away one of my children. She says, we may not have much to eat or much to drink or anything, but she says, as long as there's a breath in my body, there isn't one of my children would ever adopt one of their children. I would take them first. And that was the kind of family that we had. We were a close-knit family, and if one was in need and the other had it, we all shared. And it was always that way when we came on to California. Well, coming up to the state line, we got to the state line. We dreaded it. However, we was in better shape than others. But before I get to this, I want to tell a few experiences about this. I remember when we camped in Casa Grande, Arizona. there was a car of people traveled with us from Shakota that we knew there, and we traveled along together. And we all camped. We would camp in the same campground, and we would visit at night over the campfires, which I thought was having a good time. It's fun to me. And I was always adventurous. I still am. They call me the gypsy of the Martin family. But anyway, we've seen other people camping there, and one thing that impressed me most, now we had plenty to eat at this time. My mother was a manager. We brought canned stuff with us that we had canned all summer. And then we would buy, which I was enjoying most of all, was eating light bread. And we'd get loaves of bread. And I don't know, I think got them 5 cents then. And then we went to Day-Old Bakery in Casa Grande and just bought up a whole bunch of stuff. But that night especially, I noticed these people made coffee, and the mom and dad drank the coffee, and then they ranged the coffee ground to cool them off, and the kids all had a spoon. There was three of the children, and they fought over these coffee grounds. They ate every coffee ground in that pot and cried for more.
Was that the only thing that they had to eat?
That was the only thing they had to eat. That was the only thing that they had to eat. And I remember us sitting there, and we had filled our stomach. And my mother sat there, and she said, "I can't stand this any longer." She gathered up a bunch of stuff, and we'd been to the Day-Old Bakery, and she gathered up a bunch of stuff and took over there, which was like rolls, cinnamon rolls, and bread, and lunch meat and stuff. And she said, "Here, I think that you might like this." And I remember those kids are snatching that so fast and cramming that bread in their mouth so fast, their mouth looked like little squirrels, and they almost got choked. And so the next day, my mother, she asked them not to leave till later, and she went to the Day-Old Bakery, and she bought a whole big bag of stuff and gave them. And we done that off and on all the way. But you would pass people, and people would pass you, and we had a saying in those days. A car passed you, if you seen a car with it wasn't everybody had trucks to travel in. They just usually had just two-seated cars and sometimes one seat. But if they had one mattress on the car, they were called a poor Okie. If they had two mattresses tied on the car, they were just called just a normal, you know, family. If there was three mattresses, they were rich Okies. And so we'd always say, "Well, there goes the poor Okie, or there goes just a common Okie, or a rich Okie." Well, I guess we was rich Okies. We had three brand new mattresses. And so this was off and on all the way, and there was people traveling from Oklahoma and Missouri and Arkansas and all through here that never even as much as had a spare tire. And many, many times we stopped, and my daddy would help fix the tires. At that time, you patched them. They didn't have anything like these tires that just carries air, you know. Mm-hmm. What do you call them?
Tubeless
tires. They were all either solid tires or had tubes in them. And some of those tubes just looked like they were solid patches. In fact, some bars did. But my daddy was kind, and he was good, and he never passed a car. I don't believe he passed a car that was stopped. Some of them was hot and smoking, and some of them was broke down. And I've seen him work all day and all night on cars helping people, because we was just all in this together. And so we come on our way, and we finally got to the line. I can't remember just now where it was at. Because we came through Imperial Valley, and I can't remember where the line was at.
Somewhere between Arizona.
Check-in station. Yeah. But anyway, when we got to the check-in station, they said, "You'll have to unload your truck And my mother had been the type of person that I told you she was. She stuck her head out of the back of that car. Well, my daddy had to let this the end gate down. And she stuck her head out and she says, "We're not unloading all of this car." She says, "When you check it, you will find out why that we're not." And she went through all the rigmarole telling them what she'd done to the truck. And she says, "We've got new mattresses. Everything in here is new except our dishes and everything." Well, we had to take the sewing machine out. She had an old Singer sewing machine that she wouldn't part with. She'd made our kids' clothes ever since we was born. And so they had to set that out till he could see in the crack of this truck. Well, he took him a little broom, and he had like a dustpan and everything, and he swept out a crack or two in this, and he never got anything. Because my mother had, she had an old blanket laid down over this that she wouldn't even let step on it. And he said, and he looked at these mattresses, and he got up in the truck, and he went all through everything, and he took these mattresses up, and he looked for chinches. They call them bed bugs now, they were chinches, and that's a Mexican name for them. And he never found the bed bug, and he looked in our pillow slips, and he seen it was all new. A ticking, and everything was new, and he crawled down out of that, and he said, "Well, I want to congratulate you people." He said, "You're the cleanest Okies that's crossed this line." And he said, I've seen some good ones. Well, anyway, there was people all along the side. They were burning mattresses. Now, this was the sad thing. If your mattress had bed bugs, they took them and they burned them. And these people, they would be sitting out there without beds. I've seen them crying. Children, they would be crying. And there would be maybe two or three mattresses on fire. And if you had dried stuff, and they would check that out too. And if it had any weevils or anything in it, they would take that away from you. And some people was carrying all that they had, and they would just dump it in something. I don't remember now, they had big cans out there that they dumped things in. And if they found chinches on your clothes or bed bugs, well, they would they'd go through your clothing, and they'd check that out for lice. And there was lots of people that left there that had lice. They'd check your head and everything.
Did they check your head?
They checked our heads, but boy, our heads was as clean as a pen. Now we got lice a time or two during our life, but it was only when somebody would come and stay all night with us, and the children would have them. And my mother then, she would check kids' head that would stay all night with us, and I remember she would soak their head with lye soap and tie it up, put the hair, leave the lye soap lathers on the head, and tie it up and do ours the same way. And usually we never got lice, but that would burn, you know.
Lucky you had a scalpel.
Yeah, but we had good, pretty hair and a lot of it at that time. And so she, when we would get anything, boy, she was just clean as a pin, and she'd see that we'd ever had it just in a day or two. But
that must have been a kind of an insulting experience for you, because you were so careful about those things.
It was. It really was. And my mother, she told him, she said, "Now, we're not like all the rest of the Okies that's come out here. We're so-and-so and so-and-so." And they'd say, "Yes, we know. But usually we find something, them kind of people." Well, I'll tell you, they went through what we had, and they looked on our heads. And my mother, the day before that we had left there, she had us to wash our hair with that lye soap, and it just shined. Our scalp just shined. And so he looked at our heads and our hair and everything, and he said, "You undoubtedly are the cleanest people I've ever seen." And so I thought that was good, you know, coming from Oklahoma. But anyway, we got through the line. We weren't held up there, but about, I'd say, an hour we were held up. And
you mentioned earlier that your baby got sick during
the time.
What seemed to be the problem?
Well, my milk wasn't any good. I was I started before time. I had infection in my ovaries, and I wasn't well because I didn't recuperate before we started. And I was sick, and she was nursing me, and my other baby was so healthy, and I had milk for two or three children. In fact, I nursed another baby that the mother didn't have milk. I nursed two babies for I don't know how long, and I had more than enough milk for those two. Well, I never once dreamed that my milk wouldn't be any good, see, but I didn't know anything about what an infection would do. She cried day and night. There wasn't, you couldn't get no rest, and I'm going to tell this. Maybe I shouldn't. But when we got into Imperial Valley, she cried so much, and I was trying to pick peas, and I wasn't well enough to pick peas, but I wanted to help support, you know, the family. And everybody else could sleep but me. And I thought about committing suicide. That's the only time in my life that this has ever crossed my mind. There was this huge, huge canal that went right down through Imperial Valley that irrigated the whole country. And one night I got up, and I couldn't get no sleep, and the other girl, of course, she slept good. But I didn't want to leave one of my children. I got up, and I took the baby under one arm and the other under the other one. And there was this big walk that went across this canal, and it was like a river. And I thought, I will go out there, and I'll get in the middle of that, and I'll jump right off in it. I couldn't see no other way out, you know. And I was sleeping in a little thing out by myself, so the rest could sleep, you know, in case I couldn't work, well, they could. And I thought, I'll just get rid of it all. But when I got her under my arm, it was like a voice spoke to me and said, don't do it. And I stood there for a moment, and that baby quit crying. I can't hardly keep him crying, but I've held it.
Okay.
And she quit crying. And I went back and laid her down and laid the other down. And she never cried. She did not cry until we got the woman sober and turned light. And then she went crying again. And she was so thin. And I was worn out and being sick. So my sister, they were settled there, and they had a little cabin. And she took the baby immediately and took her in. And she had a... there was some flies, and she had a diaper, and she was waving it over the baby's face, and she touched the baby's face, and she grabbed it as little as she was and began to just stick it in her mouth. And my sister looked at her and she said, this baby's starved. And I said, she couldn't have got milk. She said, no, that don't always make the difference. And there was a fella going into town. And so she went out and she said, you bring, go up the drugstore and get me a bottle of nipple. And she had milk. And when he got back, she made that baby a half a bottle of milk and put some table syrup in it. And she went to sleep. She slept 2 days and nights. She fed her during this time, but she just had to stick the bottle in her mouth. And I just dried up. I mean, it was nothing to it. I never had no problem like some women would if your milk was good, because I was ill. And so she kept the baby. She kept the baby out there and let me recuperate a few days. And then she began to put on weight in a week. You wouldn't know that baby. And so after I went to work then again, helping them pick cotton, which I wasn't able. I was too weak to carry my sack. But my husband and my daddy would carry my sack. And then I heard of a job. Oh, when we went to picking cotton here in California, it was 50 cents a hundred. And if he was a good cotton picker, you could make $1.50 a day. My daddy could pick 300 easily. He never had no thumb on one hand, but he was a good cotton picker. And so that was money. Boy, in that day, you could take $1.50 and go buy a big bill of groceries, almost as much as you could carry. And so we was having quite a bit to eat. Boy, we thought we was doing all right. Well, I heard of a job in Bakersfield, this woman wanting somebody to work. She had a young baby, and it was the only one she had, and she was 40. And she didn't want to do the work or something, and so she was advertising for somebody to come and work for her. Well, I got a hold of her, and she found out that I had two children. She thought, well, that would be the right thing, you know. So I worked for $2 a week, was there day and night, and I worked 3 weeks, I guess it was. And to me, that was a pretty good job. It was better than picking cotton. So then I had to come home. My mother got ill. Well, she was ill all the time, but she got worse and couldn't take care of the baby and my sister. She was having to help her husband, and she couldn't take care of it. So I come back. Well, right after that, then we moved to Arvin, California. Now, we was... Yeah, I got to back up. I was in the...
Okay, you were in the Imperial Valley.
Yeah. Then we come to the lake bottom.
The lake bottom?
Kern Lake. Kern Lake, and which is called the lake bottom. And there was lots of farmers there, and they had lots of cabins. Each farmer would have his own cabin. We worked for Banducci. And there was other farmers, I can't remember their names right now.
Okay, just back up 1 second, back to the okay. Imperial Valley. You were picking peas. How long did you stay in the Imperial Valley?
I can't rightly call, but I'm glad you brought my attention to that, because there's some things I want to tell about what happened there. I don't know where we was at, a month or what, 3 weeks or a month.
And that would have been in 1936?
No. That would have been in 19, and wait a minute, yeah, that would have been because my baby become a month old, and this was in December.
This is a continuation of Tape 2, Session 1 with Loy Holmes.
Okay.
That part's unimportant.
Okay.
Just identify.
I'll go back to Imperial Valley. We camped there, and people was making grass houses. Now, I don't know if anybody ever seen these or not, but as usual, we made the best grass house. We had this huge tarpaulin that I had spoke about earlier that we put over our truck, and you would put up like an old rail fence. This is like what they use. They'd put poles in the ground and then poles across, and they had a certain kind of weed there that grew about 4 feet high. I don't know what it's called, but they'd cut that down and put it in bundles, and they'd weave this through this. Now, some people would put them over the top and put this grass over the top, but we put our tarpaulin over the top, and we made a big one, and so we had this. And it was bigger and better than what the rest had. I'm not prejudiced, but that's just the way it happened. But I seen people there, and I must go to an experience that I had there, but people that didn't have as much as a weed house, the men that would be alone, they would dig back into the bank and just have it was sandy, and they would dig back into the bank. And there, if they had a quilt or a blanket or a pad or something, they would put it there and they'd sleep on it. Now, some of them would have an extra shirt, and they would take sticks and drop down then over the top of where they'd dug back in, and they'd put each sleeve in this and just make a slight covering for them, because it would dew at night. There would be dew at night. And then you would see little fires all along the canal bank of the morning, and making their coffee and cooking them something to eat to pick peas. And there was lots of single men at this time. And then there would be men and women like this. Maybe they'd have one or two children, and they wouldn't even have as much as a car or anything. And there was one woman that they had they built a little small thing. It was about 4 feet wide and about 8 feet long, and they had a trough built in it. Now, I compared it to our feed troughs at home. They just had some sticks in the ground and some boards over the bottom, and it was just over to one side solid. They had solid boards in it, and they had some just like straw or weeds or something in it, an old blanket over it. And I had seen this woman. She's big and pregnant. And I had talked to her a few times, and she had come over and seen my baby. Well, one day, we had come home for lunch, and I didn't go back with them to the field that day. And I heard these screams. They didn't live very far from us, just, I'd say maybe 100 yards. And I heard these screams, and I told my mother, I said, I got to run over here and see what's happening to this woman. And I went over there, and her husband at this time had left her, just had walked off and left her. She was alone, and she was trying to have her baby. Well, I didn't know what to do, but I said, I'll go get somebody. She said, please don't leave me. The babies are coming. And so I just grabbed a hold of her hand, and I looked, and sure enough, the baby's head was coming. And I grabbed a hold of her hand, and she pulled on me, and that baby was born right there in that trough. Well, us together, her and I, we cut its navel cord. And so I had to run down to the creek, the canal, and get ice-cold water to wash that baby. I made sure it was crying. I studied it a time or two. And having these two babies myself, I knew what they'd done. And so I went down to the canal, and I got a bucket of cold water. And I come back, and I cleaned that baby up. And I said, now, where's the clothes? She says, I don't have one piece of clothing for this baby. I said, nothing? She said, nothing. I said, well, I'll run to the house. And I'll to our place, and I said, I'll find something. I never had hardly anything either. And I got it a little shirt and a little gown, and I brought two diapers, and I got some pins, and I put that on that baby. And we left about 2 days after that, and that woman was still there in that thing, and I don't know what ever happened to her. I've often wondered. I've just often wondered if that little baby survived, or who took care of her in that time. They never had welfare like they've got now. They never had people to go see about them. Now, right after that, they started it, after we come on in, but, let's see, where was I at after we got, we was there in the lake bottom, wasn't we?
Well, let me ask you one question about the pea picking in the Imperial Valley. How did the growers treat the pea pickers? Did you think they were fair, or what was that like? There's been a lot of talk about some of them took advantage of the people, and others said that they were treated fairly.
We were treated fairly. In fact, we never did have nobody looking down our neck. We was used to hard work. We believed in hard work. We didn't shirk our job. We didn't try to get something for nothing. You didn't in picking peas nor cotton either. You either had it or you didn't. You got paid for what you picked. And so, and my daddy was a firm believer in his children working, and I appreciate that. He raised a bunch of kids that wasn't lazy, and we've never expected people to give us anything. And so our boss was real good. He would tell all of his hands, he'd say, pick as many of these peas as you want and take them home and cook them. And needlessly tell you, We took home plenty of peas every night and shelled them and cooked them. We ate a lot of them raw, too. I often said I ate about as many raw as I picked to begin with. I always did like green peas. And so, but we always had green peas while we were there. And I heard from different fields, we only picked for one man, I mean different bosses, that they wouldn't even let him take home any to eat. And they would sneak them in their clothes and take them home. Well, I think that's being very rude, you know, especially in that day and time when things were so hard. I can't remember what we got paid for picking peas. It wasn't much, but it was enough. It was enough to eat on. I remember we would walk across this a little bridge over to this store. And everybody met over there the evening, and I remember us buying sardines, which we never had, and we'd buy cans of salmon, we'd make salmon patties, and as I say, we'd buy light bread and crackers, and well, I thought we was living high on hog, myself, we were, and we loved it, and we wasn't any of us, you know, doing without, but it was good to us, we saved money. My daddy had money,
yes. But
he was close with it because he had went through all these hardships, and that was one thing I can say about my daddy. I can't ever remember but one time that he couldn't reach a way down and pull a little money out somewhere. But I do remember one time, the first year that we made a crop after leaving the store, we'd went somewhere else. I can't remember where he's at, but he'd lost his shirt. And that was losing everything we had.
Mm-hmm.
And we came back, and his brother had died in Arkansas, and he just bought him a new pair of shoes, and this seemed to run in the family. My mother and her sister married brothers. Me and my sister married brothers. But anyway, my aunt had given my daddy his brother's shoes, but he wouldn't wear them. They were very close together, and I remember my daddy plowing ground in the spring, breaking ground, froze ground barefooted, and he would tie these gunny sacks around his feet to keep them from freezing until one day he'd come in, and my mother had one of the children to get these shoes, and she looked at him, and she said, Willie Martin, as I told you how she was, she said, you put these shoes on, and don't say no. If your brother was living, he'd want you to do this. And she says he'd turn over in his grave if he knew you was plowing barefooted with these new shoes that while Daddy put them on, he wore them out. But that was just a little reminiscing way back there then. Now where am I?
Okay, in the Imperial Valley.
Okay.
What did you do with your children while you were picking peas?
My mother kept them. She was in bed most of the time, but she kept those little children.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why it was so hard, you know. She really wasn't able, but she done the best she could. She done her part, and I would come in home a little early and fix the dinner at night and ever what that we was going to eat. And as I say, we had plenty. It seemed to me like we got little tickets. We picked peas in something, and we poured them in baskets. And when we would take a basket in, they'd weigh them, and they'd give you a ticket with that amount on there. And then we would cash them in. And it was like picking strawberries. That's the way it was with strawberries. And then we'd go at the store, and if we needed anything, I'd run off to the store and get it, which we usually always did need something. We was drinking a lot of milk at that time. We was used to milk. And so, having milk in Oklahoma, so I'd always go get milk and something for supper. But we saved money with eating good and wages being so cheap. But
you had, what, about seven adults working in the field? No, your mother didn't
work. No, my mother didn't work. The three children didn't work. The three little ones.
The nephew was a little one?
Yes, he was little. He was just 6 months older than my oldest girl. And they were all under 3 years old. So she kept them, and the rest of us worked. and the feeling. Some wouldn't work as long as others, you know, but we did work, and just every little bit helped.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saved some extra money besides what my dad had, and we came on, and as I say, we landed in the lake bottom. Okay.
And that's, you were going to pick cotton?
We started picking cotton there. My brother-in-law and my sister lived there, and my second oldest brother, he'd come out with them. My brother-in-law had got to kind of be boss over Bandusa's ranch there, the foreman. So they had taken a cotton trailer that was on wheels, and they had... they never had enough cabins for the people that was coming out there, and they took and put like plywood around this and put a top on it, and this is what we lived in, was a cotton trailer fixed up. And boy, we was glad to get it. That was lovely. And as I say, I went in town and worked about 3 weeks, and then I came back, and after that, then my daddy had heard about this Arvin, about that they had more things than cotton picking over there. So him and my mother went over one weekend and checked it out. In fact, I think we all went. And he got a job from this big farmer. He had lots of grapes. And with our family, he said, I will furnish you a house. And so we got a 3-bedroom house, big white house, sitting right out in the big... grape vineyard, and boy, I'm telling you, that was something. And so we worked, and there we worked for 15 cents an hour. But I thought that was living, and it was living, because the groceries was cheap, everything was cheap. But time we'd work all week, we'd pool our money, and we'd go to Arvin, and there was Dan's store on the corner. And we go to Dan's store, and boy, we got our groceries and everything else that we needed, you know, our clothes and shoes and ever what. But we found our little church, and we went to church faithfully there, and there's where that I become a Christian just at a young age. And let's see, where did I go from here? Well, we lived there, we lived there, I guess, a year or so, and then my father heard of this place in Lamont where they were selling lots, and so he said, well, we're going to stay in California the rest of our life, and he said, I'm going to go over and see about these lots, and... so they were selling them for $10 down and $10 a month, $300 a lot. And so he purchased him one. And now I'm ahead of my story. We moved from on the farm on a man's place, a Christian man's place. My daddy wanted his own place. He always wanted his own place. So he heard that they were giving boxcar lumber, if anybody would tear a boxcar apart. So this fellow said, you can build you a small something to live in on the back of my place if you want to, which he had about 2 acres there, or 3, I don't remember. But anyway, my daddy went and tore down boxcars and built us a big one-room house. Well, I say one-room. It was about a 1460, something like that. And we lived there, I guess, a year. And then he heard about this place in Lamont and went over there and purchased him the place. So he said, well, what we're going to do, we're going to tear this down side by side, and I'm going to move it on my truck, and we're going to put it up. So this is what he done. Well, my husband and I had to move out. We moved into Gilbert Emick, they call it tent house. And so it was a little room. It wasn't even this big. It was about a 9 by 8, something like that. And it was walled up 4 boards high and had a tent over it. And so We lived there, and oh, how my heart did yearn to go and get us a place, but my husband couldn't see it. He just didn't think he could see it. He was working at everything he could get to work at and couldn't find enough to hardly keep us going. But anyway, one morning, he had got up and built a fire. My folks got their place moved, and they'd been there, I guess, a couple of months, and they'd moved over there. One morning, my husband got up to make a fire, and he built a fire in this little wood stove, little wood cook stove, and the top of the tent was too close to the stove pipe, and he jumped back in bed, and I had been asleep, but I just hadn't waked up, and I was just laying there, and I smelled smoke, opened my eyes, and the whole top of that tent was on fire, and I grabbed my children and jumped out the side of it. I never tried to get out the door because the stove was sitting by the door. And I grabbed my kids and jumped over the side. I grabbed one of them and jumped over, and he pulled the other one out to me. And he grabbed water, and I never will forget, he was in his shorts, and he grabbed the bucket and began to throw water up there, and there were some neighbors up, and so they grabbed their water buckets, was getting water out of faucets outside the tent. And they run over and they got that out, but the biggest part of it was burned off. So he said, well, I guess we just well to go over to Lamont and see about, see if we can purchase a lot. Well, we did. We came to Lamont and we got the second lot from my daddy. Somebody had already got the one next to him, and we got the one next to them. And so my husband said, well, I never like to think about getting on, getting any help, but he said, I'm going to go up and see if I can get on at the WPA. He said, in order to get moved and everything, we're going to have to do it. Well, they kindly sewed something else over that tent, and we was there for about another month, but he did. He got up and went and got on WPA, and he went to work. But they never got nothing for nothing then. They work, and they work like horses. They would gather these men up in trucks, and they would take them up in the mountain. And they built roads and done a little bit of everything. And I know he'd come in at night so dirty and so tired, but he was glad to have it. And I believe the best that I can remember, he was making $27 a month. 5 days a week. 6 days a week. No, he worked on Saturday and Sunday, 5 days a week. So the first month, we took that money, and we went and got some flooring and some tube floors. And my daddy helped him, and we got railroad ties for the sleepers, and we put down our floor, and we put our shell of the house up, the frame of it, and we put the floor down. Okay. That was that. So the next month, we got lumber. We got lumber to bring it up 4 feet. We got foot wide siding, groove siding. We had enough to put the sides up that month. Okay, we took that same old tarpaulin that had been through the mail, and we put it over the top. And so we moved in. I never was as happy in my life. That was like a mansion to me after what I'd been through after leaving Oklahoma. Now, we always had houses to live in Oklahoma, and usually a good house for there. But we moved in that. Well, I was pregnant. While we had a wood stove, and while we lived there, and so we figured every month we would get enough, we'd take enough lumber out besides our living to put another row of boards around our house. So we done this till we got it 8 foot tall. And then we still had the canvas over the top. Well, we knew it was going to take more to get our shingles and the sheeting for the top. But during this time, I was about 3 months pregnant, sick. Was I ever sick? I couldn't keep anything but crackers and 7-Up on my stomach. it come, and people as old as I am, they'll think back in that time, and they will remember this. Anybody ever hears this? We had a 3-day sandstorm, one of the worst that they had, and I don't know when. And the only way that we could survive, me and the children, would be set up in the bed with the covers over our head. And my husband would tie a towel or something around his face, and he would walk to the store and get us bologna and crackers and bread and 7-Up. And we would sit in under that, and we would eat that. For 3 days we'd done this. There got to be so much sand. Every so often I'd have to raise up in the bed and let this sand fall off of the covers.
What year was that in?
That was in 38. It was 38. It was the year my boy was born. He was, he was born in August. I guess I was more than 3 months at that time. But anyway, when this sandstorm was over, we would sleep. The bed was so dirty and gritty that you turn over, it really hurts you. And when it was over, we had to take the shovel and scoop the sand out of our house. And it taken us, I don't know, probably a couple of days to really get everything straightened out like it ought to be. But we got that over with, and we kept working on our house. We got the top on it, and August, I had my baby. And after I had my baby, and he was big enough to leave with somebody, I chopped, well, at first, when my baby was 3 weeks old, I had a nervous breakdown. I wasn't well at all, and me and my husband got in a fight. Maybe I ain't supposed to tell this. He kicked me real good, and I had a nervous breakdown. And I passed out, and they taken me to hospital, and they taken my baby along, and I was in the hospital about 2 weeks, and there was about 3 or 4 days that I didn't know anything, and I was hemorrhaging. And when the first day that I come to, the doctor tried to tell me that I had had a miscarriage. Well, I knew better than that. And but come to find out, it was a nervous breakdown. And I didn't get well. Oh, I guess it was 2 months. But we never had a car at this time. And there was a county nurse that was coming out and seeing my mother at this time and dressing her eye. And my mother had her to bring me out one day from the hospital when she was coming. And my baby was in and out the hospital with this diarrhea. Babies were dying like flies at that time with diarrhea. And he was in out the hospital several times. But he finally came through it, and things began to look better for us, and I began to get in better health. And so they had water on the back of each lot, and we had to walk plumb to the back. We had outdoor toilets, and there was a lot of, what do you call this fever that you get, so many people die with? Typhoid. There was lots of typhoid at that time. In fact, my sister-in-law and her husband moved on the back of our lot in a tent, and she took typhoid and almost died. But I went to chopping cotton, and the next year, I guess it was. Yeah, it had to be the next year, because cotton chopping was over that year. And so the next year, I chopped cotton and bought a water pipe and brought the water to my house. And I brought it right up to the kitchen door. Our room was a 14 by 16. We lived in that till the war come along.
Okay, let me go back a second and ask you, when you were hospitalized and your baby was in and out of the hospital for that amount of time, and, you know, you were just managing to eke by with the mm-hmm. income that you had, how did you pay for that, and what kind of medical care were you able to get at that time?
We didn't have to pay for it. I went to Kern General, and if it hadn't been for Kern General on several occasions, I don't know what we'd done. I went to Kern General when my baby was born. He was born there, so they had my records and my file right there handy. And this was a bad time, too. I was in the hospital 3 days of trying to give birth to him, and I never could give birth to him, so they had to take him. And I kindly thought maybe this was part of his illness. They mashed his head real bad, but he wasn't mentally ill, thank the Lord. And in fact, he's a real well man now. He's a minister of the gospel. And so at one time...
One more question before you go on. How did you feel that you were treated in Kern General?
I was treated quite well, I would say, under the circumstance of as many people. There was 5 women in the room with me that had babies. I didn't think that they give me the cure. I think my baby should have been born a long time. I kept telling them, I can't have this baby. I had had 2 before, and I knew there was something wrong. I could bear down so much, but then there was a certain stage that it was like there was a, what do you call it, a recession. It would go back the other way. Mm-hmm. And he would just come right back up, and till I was wore out. Yeah. And this may sound funny, but I used an old grandma recipe to really get far enough along if they'd done something. After 3 days, there was a girl that was in the room with me, and she hadn't been in there but about 3 hours. And her pains wasn't very close, and this was her first baby. And I said, well, I'm tired of fooling around with this. I said, I'm going to do what my grandma told me to do. I said, when they bring me my breakfast, I'm going to take every bit of my pepper. And she says, well, what does that do? I said, that'll make you go into labor real fast. And she said, well, I'm going to take mine too. So when they brought us, they didn't have it in little paper things. They brought a salt and a pepper shaker on each tray, and which mounted about two teaspoonfuls of pepper. Well, I just took mine and went in the bathroom, and I just turned it up, and I took it in 2 whacks, but I had me a big glass of water, and I poured half up my mouth and washed it down, put the other half in there and washed it down. And so she done the same thing. And I'll tell you, about the same time, we both went into hard labor. I mean, hard labor. You first get it hot. It'll just, this may help somebody that's going to listen to this, yeah. But you just burn up, and then you go into hard labor. Well, we both went in. They took her into the main delivery room, but they had to take me into emergency delivery room, one close by. And so, but I was in there 5 hours trying to give birth to this baby. And he would go down so far with a bearing down pain, and the minute that pain's gone, he would absolutely come right back up here.
Just start being here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is it registered? And so after about 5 hours, they called in more doctors, and they all watched me for a while. And so one of the main doctors said, which was old Dr. Joe Smith, he was over the hospital, he said, you just well to go ahead, you're going to have to do it. So the next thing I remembered was putting ether on me. And so then the next thing I remembered kind of waking up, and I felt in my stomach, and I said, oh, thank goodness, it's over. And so... that was that. That's the way I had my baby, and I was in there 10 days, and they used to keep them. They never let me get up, and that was the saddest mistake they ever made. And I think the way they do, I think they're pushing it a little bit now, but I'm glad that they do get people up quicker, because you get along better. And now, where was I about the...
Okay, let me backtrack just a second and ask you, the tent house that you lived in, before you started building your own house, the one that the roof burned out or the
yeah.
top burned out,
mm-hmm.
was that owned by a grower, or was that part of one of those government camps?
No, it was owned by a private owner. He had came in there 2-3 years before we did, and he had bought this land, and he would build, make the floor and build these up and put tents over them. He rented them.
See.
Rented them for about $2 or $3 a month.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the way that was.
Okay, now the other question that I had is, we have to backtrack even further, because where did you meet your husband again after you and your family started moving out to
Casa Grande?
Okay, so you drove to Casa Grande, you came up, and then you all came on.
He had been over here in Kern Lake, working. He had left there and went to Kern Lake and was working over with his brother, which married my sister. And so when he heard that we was coming through and we was going to stop in Casa Grande and visit my mother's friend, well, he started hitchhiking it out there to meet us. And the night that he got in there, he got in a terrible car accident. He was riding in the back of the pickup, and the pickup wrecked, and it killed. There was two riding in the back and two in the seat, and it killed every one of them but him. And he was unconscious, but he had didn't know what he was doing, but he had carried two posts and laid in the road and laid down between them. And there was a school teacher came by, and she was afraid to stop at first. And she pulled on up further, and she seen that he had blood all over him. And she got out and went, and she was aware that he was unconscious. And so she stayed there with him till some other cars come by, and she made arrangements for somebody to bring him into the hospital.
Mm.
And that night, well, I say the hospital, they took him to jail. They seen the wrecked car, and they thought maybe he was the one driving and that he was drunk. And so they put him in jail, and he come to in jail, and he told them that his wife was there and told them who that they was with. And they called the house, and we told him yes. And so they brought him down.
Oh.
And he never had a piece of hide on his face. He was so skinned up and bunged up, but he never had any bones broken. So that was a bad experience.
Oh, yes. And then the other question that I had is, during the time that you were living in the tent house and building your house in Lamont, your husband was working for WPA?
Yes, he did.
Okay. So he worked for WPA from roughly 37 to 40? Did you say 3 years?
I'd say yes, or maybe 2 years, because he was a pretty good gambler, and he went to work at the smokehouse in Lamont. And he done this while he was working on WPA, and he'd play poker, and he'd win money extra. But they finally put him on as a bartender. And he would bartender in the day and play poker at night. And so we was living good. I was... I had always been raised that this was wrong, and I had deep feelings about this, and it was for a long time that I wouldn't even spend the money that he would take from gambling, because I knew the people that come out here, what kind of shape they was in, and I knew some of the men that was gambling, and I knew, and I have even went, my husband was very free-hearted with me, and he would give me all the money he had, and he'd just take back so much. I have went to these people's house, and I would give the mothers money that he never did. In fact, I never did tell him I didn't.
Hmm.
I'd give them $2, $3, or $5, and I'd say, go buy you some groceries. And they'd say, well, why are you doing this? I'd say, just because I want to. But he would tell me, so-and-so was in a poker game last night, and they lost every bit they had. And I couldn't take it, because I was raised honest and do unto others as you wish to be done by. And he's taking their money, so I just take it and give it back to the family.
Is that what you got into a big fight about?
I can't reminisce right now. Well, yeah, I do too. It come to me. I had forgotten. I got up that morning. He had made the fire, and I got up, and my little daughter had got up, and I was putting her shoes on her, and he went back to bed, and he was smoking, and he went to flip his cigarette, and he intended for it to light the stove,
And when it did, as she just put on her little shirt and it hit her on the tummy, and it just stuck. And she went screaming, and I was looking at her shoes, and I didn't know what it was. And then she was scratching her tummy, and I seen that, and I knocked it off, and it just had stuck there and just made a little hole. And she was screaming and crying. And I jumped on him about that and was criticizing him, and finally wound up accusing him of doing it for a purpose. And so he jumped up. Of course, he didn't do it for a purpose, but I was mad, and he was too. And he jumped up, and he kicked me, and he had something, and he had his bell for laying there. And he grabbed that bell, and he was going to give me a whooping. And I stuck my head in the corner to keep him from hitting me with the belt. And I wound up then with my nervous breakdown before the day was over. And I had him arrested.
What happened with that?
I had him arrested and picked up. And the law's come and got him and was taking him into Baker's Field. And he was playing and gambling with all of them and serving them drinks. And a honky-tonking rhythm. And they took him about 2 miles up the road and let him out. And he came back to us and threatened to kill me. And my mother happened to be there. And I said she was half Cherokee Indian, and my daddy didn't pull nothing on her. And she just, what he said, you just open your mouth. And he said, I'll kid you. She just kind of eased over to the where I had a cabinet there, and I had a great long butcher knife, and it was razor sharp. She just walked over to him, and she said, Russell Barber, she said, you may whip my daughter and get by with it, and you may do a lot of things, but she said, I dare you and double dare you lay your hand on her now. And she said, you don't have the guts to touch me. That's what she said. She said, you'll touch the last, and if you ever touch this girl again. And he never touched me anymore. He's afraid of my mother. But anyway, where were we?
Okay, now just let me, so you did go back together again after the...
Yes, it's hard times.
One other question I wanted to ask you, was that sort of the way that women were treated, that men pretty much had whatever way that they... whatever they decided to do and however that women sort of had to stand by.
That is right. And men really took advantage. Now, I won't say all men, but some of them like mine did, and I could name off quite a few that was doing the same thing, and the women stood by. Now, I had my little way of getting even with him, but in the long run, he usually won, but there come a time then in 35 he'd went to run around with another woman, and I had caught him with her, and I had faced her and him together, and she said that she'd never see him no more, and he didn't want to leave me, and he didn't want me to leave him. He wanted me and wanted to take me too. And he wanted this family, but he also wanted to tomcat around a little bit. Well, he finally got her pregnant. And he's spending as much time with her as he was with us. And so I couldn't take that. So I went and sued him for divorce, and I had to leave town because he would kill me, because at this time he was drinking quite a bit. And he told me, if you ever leave me, sue me for divorce, I'll quit you. I mean, I'll kill you. And so I knew what he would, because I knew how, he's mean. He fought all the time. He whooped everything. He never took a whipping. And so I went and sued him for divorce, and I told my lawyer, and my lawyer said, I don't want you there when they serve papers on him. You get everything ready. You get your kids taken care of. Don't leave your kids just running loose there, because he can bring this against you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Give a woman, at this time we had built a little rent house in our back, and there was a lady living there, and I give her a check, I know I give her cash, and had her to write me a receipt, keep these children. Well, I got in my car, and by this time I had acquired a car. He had had some bad luck in the shipyard that he worked in during the war, and he got a settlement, and he did let me get a car. As I say, he was not stingy with me. He would give me money, and I could get what I wanted. Now, that was one good thing about him, and he never questioned me, because he always said I could handle money better than he could, and always had something to show for it, which he couldn't. And so he did let me get me a good little car, which I paid $700 for. I take this car, and I went to Long Beach, and I had friends down there. I had a cousin, and I stayed with her till the day before the hearing, and I snuck back into town and seen the kids, and then went to court. And so he had sued me for desertion, but I had followed my lawyer's instructions, and so I had my receipt and everything, and I had a woman that had real good character, taking care of them, feeding them well, and had proof that I had kept check, calling, and everything. And so, boy, my lawyer turned him every way but loose. And he carried a gun all the time, see. And I turned this in, and all the time they got through with him, he couldn't say anything. And they brought up about this woman, you know, and he had to admit she was pregnant and all this stuff. And, oh, they made him look like nothing. And, of course, I got the home, and I got the children. And by this time, we had built on, and we had three nice rooms. And we separated, and he went to living with her. And he never did quit wanting me to go back to him till the day he died. And he didn't die till 70, I hope she hears this, till 70, my other husband I married again, and he died in 76, and let's see, and he died the year before. He died in 75, and my last husband died in 76. And they're both buried in the same graveyard.
You were divorced in 45, honey?
I was divorced in 35.
No, it had to be 45.
I mean 45, honey. You'll have to correct me on this. 45. Yeah.
Okay. All right. How about if we stop there for today, and I come back tomorrow morning, and we finish, and you can look back through your notes and decide if there are any things that you've missed that you're wrong.
Okay.
And we'll make up from here.
Okay.
Okay.
May I say something? This is an interview with me, Lori Holmes. Okay. And we'll just see if it takes now. I think it is. It was this duty.
Okay, Mrs. Holmes. After all of that...
Are you going to... Did you... turn it off. You gotta
this is a second interview with Lori Holmes of 1109 Valencia Drive, Bakersfield, California. The interview was held on February 25, 1981 for the California State College Odyssey Project. Okay. Batteries. Okay, Mrs. Holmes, when we stopped taping yesterday, we were talking about your life with your husband. And I think it was in like about the 40s as he and you began to have some difficulty together, and he was doing some drinking and gambling and running around. Before we go any further with that, I wondered, one of the things that I was curious about as I got to thinking about our taping yesterday was... you were living in Lamont, and you were building a house at that time, and I expect that your three children were going to school there in Lamont?
One of them was.
Okay. Some people have talked to me about the way that their children were treated because they were migrants from Oklahoma, that there was some treatment that wasn't really so good. I wonder if your children experienced anything like that when they were going to school.
If they did, I wasn't aware of it. I taken my children always the first day, and I made it a point to get acquainted with the teachers. And I tried to
take part in the functions and things, which I think really helped. And I joined the PTA. I could hardly afford it, but I always managed because I always, this was one thing, I didn't join it at first. And my first child that started school, she said the teacher would always say something about it. So then I was aware that it was very important that to her, my daughter, as well as myself, that I joined the PTL. And I worked for a living because it was right after that that my husband and I separated. And so I wasn't able to take part in all the functions, but if something fell on the night that I didn't have to work, I would have to serve and this. And so I think this made a lot of difference. Of course, they came when they were young, and they didn't have a lot of reconstruction to do like I've had to do, and haven't done too well at that. But anyway, I feel like that they were fair with them. And they were good teachers in those days, and my children learned real easy and good, and I could tell they had good teachers because they always sent home homework with them, and I would help them with that. I remember when my baby started to school, and I taken him up that day, and of course the other two had already begun. And he was the youngest, and I taken him up, and I had him all dressed up real cute, and the teachers just had a fit over him, and which, like, tickled me to death. But anyway, he stayed that day, and all the little children was crying. That was their first day of school. And he looked at me, and he said, "Mommy, what are they crying for?" And I said, and he said, "They act like babies." And I said, "Yeah, you're a great big boy, aren't you?" And he said, "Yeah." So he went to school 2 days, and was just glad to get off. And so the third day I was standing in the door watching him, and he started walking off, and he got down the road just a little ways, and he put his hand in his pockets and turned around and come back, and he said, looked at me, and he said, "I don't believe I'll go to school today." Just like, you know. And so I had a time explaining to him that he did have to go to school, and he didn't like that. And so I had to take him that day, and as we walked and we talked, and but it was good. Lamont was good for me. I have no complaints. My children all started in Lamont, and then they went to Mountain View, all three of them. Lamont was the first school they ever went to, and then they went on to Mountain View. And then my boy went to high school in Arvin. But a lot of people has a lot of complaints about Lamont, and a lot even about California. But I can say that it's done nothing but good for me. Now, it isn't the same as it was when I came. Bakersfield used to be a wonderful place to live, and it is as far as I'm concerned. Of course, we do have lots of crime and stuff like that, but they are having it other places too, so we can't say it's just Bakersfield. But it was at Lamont that we got our foothold. As I think I said yesterday, that we built this little 14-16 room, and we got our roof on it. And as I said, that we had taken this month by month and would just do a little bit each month because my husband was only drawing $27 a month on this WPA, but he would work elsewhere. And he began to gamble a little, and he'd take his gambling money, and we'd fix up the house. And then I think I said I chopped cotton in 40, and I brought the water to the house, not in the house. It wasn't for quite a few years before I got the water in the house and got a sink. But by winter, the house was really livable, but we didn't have it sealed. We had no ceiling on the top, nor no wallboard on the side. And I think it was perhaps a couple of more years before we got all that in. And we never had closed closets and things like that. We never had that many clothes.
We had nails on the wall, and we hung our clothes on the wall. But it's different now. You have big closets, more closets than you can get in them. And for that reason, I say California has been good to me. And then came the war. I never will forget the day my husband was cutting my brother-in-law's hair, and we had a little radio sitting up on a little shelf, and all at once they broke in, and they said that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And I remember how my heart just sank, and then just a little bit, the president, come on, I don't even remember who the president was, you?
Roosevelt.
And he came on just right after that and declared war. And it seemed like everybody was so sad. They were standing out in the yard. They were talking. We knew the boys would be drafted. Many husbands would be drafted. My husband was right in drafting age. And I didn't much care for him getting drafted. I told him one day, I said, well, you want to fight so bad. He's always fighting me and everybody else. I said, you want to fight so bad? I said, maybe this will be good. You just go over there and fight the war. And but he didn't have to go. He was healthy enough to go. And maybe I shouldn't tell this, but I will. Him and another fellow, they had heard through, if they would drank whiskey and vinegar together, that their blood pressure would be up. And I believe it's true, because there was three of them that run together, and they were just like a pack. And they all went for their physical, and every one of them had high blood pressure and was turned down. And of course, they quit drinking as soon as they got back, so their blood pressure dropped again. I was so mad.
Kind of hoping that he'd get.
I was hoping that he would go, because I had, by this time, I'd had so much trouble, and I was so weary, and I was taking care of my mother. She was dying with cancer, and I was taking care of her and fighting with him and taking care of the children and staying by myself a lot anyhow. And so it would have been good, I think, for him if he would have went. I think he would have come back appreciating his home and his children and wife and family more.
When you think back on that time, what do you think caused your husband to start running around and drinking and all of that kind of stuff?
Well, he never drank, and when we was in Oklahoma, and he didn't run around. Now, it works both ways, I think, sometimes. Hard times and depression sometimes draws you together, and you lean on each other, and you share more, and try to figure out things, and so therefore you have more communication. Okay, when then we got to California, and different, you know, and there was more work, and more places to go, more places to hang out, and seemed like all the men would meet down at this this place, the smokehouse, which anybody that came here then knows where the smokehouse is, still there. And they'd just meet and laugh and talk and cut up and start their little beer drinking, and it just went from worse to worse. And so then they began to get self-confident. And, of course, there was a lot of women at this time doing the same thing. And so they began to flirt around and just take a new interest on life and to know that they wasn't just the old farmer, you know, back in Oklahoma. They were noticed. And I think this went to some of their heads. And, of course, the women at this time now was just something like we was when we come out here. We hadn't learned yet that we'd been liberated and that we could, you know, that we had a life of our own. Myself, now some did, but myself, I was a very home-bodied person, and I thought that, you know, and I still believe that a woman is supposed to take care of the house and her children and make things comfortable. So when her husband goes out and works all day and comes in, that she would have him a good meal and have the house clean, the children clean, and greet him with a smile, which I did. But that didn't work either. you know, it works so long, but then they get tired looking at you smile and they want to look at somebody else. So this is when it all started, and it got worse and worse until the time came that he had gotten, the war was on. And well, first we moved down to Lomita, California, and he worked in defense. He built ships, and we was down there, I guess a couple of years, something like that.
What years would those have been?
I'm trying to see. It was right after the war broke out. What was that, 41?
42.
42?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he went in 42 and worked through 42 and 43 and perhaps, I don't know, 44, I don't know. We was back home, I think, by 44. But anyway, I stayed home and taking care of the children for almost a year and would go down once in a while. And he would come home biggest part of the time on weekends.
Well, he went to Lomita to live and work.
Yes.
He stayed in Lamar.
Uh-huh. Yes, because we had our little house and the children were in school, or at least one of them. And then I had my mother I was trying to take care of. But then finally, I moved down with him when he got a house. It was impossible to find a house, but finally he did find a house for us, and I moved down there with him. And then later on, we moved back to Lamont, and it was then really, really, that things began to get bad, because money was not scarce at this time. There were lots of defense plants, and so many boys went off to war, and some husbands, till there was plenty of work. And so money was just flowing freely, and the more it flowed, the worse the men got. And those that stayed here had theirself a ball. There were so many women left behind, and girls without sweethearts and husbands. I think it went to the men's head. I really do. The girls and women would just fall all over them. And I know my husband would come home laughing sometimes and tell me things about, like, some old women trying to make him. And so it went to his head, I'm sure. And so he got to playing around. He got this lady pregnant. But we lived together till almost time for her baby to be born. And he was spending more time with her than he was myself. And so I had all I could take, and I went up and sued him for divorce. And he liked to die when they served the papers on him, and I knowed to get out of town because he had told me he'd kill me. And sure enough, when they served the papers on him, he grabbed a pistol and he ran home and looked all through the house, and run to two other people's house and looked all through them, and I'm sure he would have killed me. So anyway, I got the divorce, and I was granted the children and the house. I had a good reputation, and I was a Christian. I went to church, and there was no question that I would have the children. Well, he really went down. He got to drinking more, and he went to living with this lady, and that baby was born, and then right away she was pregnant again. And so he got down till he was coming over and borrowing from me. And he told my children when I left him, or when they when we went to court that day and they gave him orders that he would have to move his things out of the house, they told me not to go home. They were going to send a constable out there. And I waited around in the park for a long time, and I went home because they was afraid he had a bad record by this time, and cutting and beating people. So I went to the park, and I stayed till I thought perhaps they were out there, and when I went home they hadn't got there yet. But he was there. He was sitting there in the house. And so I walked in, like, scared me to death. So I walked in the kitchen. I had a big table sitting right in the middle of the kitchen, and because we had a couple of more rooms on by this time that we'd built while we was down south. And he followed me around the table, crying and begging me to just stand still. He thought if he'd get a hold of me and hold me, that he could talk to me. And I never let him touch me because I was afraid that I would soften. And I was crying, he was crying, and he told me that he didn't want this, that he wanted me and his children. And he said, I don't love her. But see, I had talked to her before that, and she told me that he said that he loved her and didn't love me. So I got them together, and I faced him in it. And he, of course, he thought that he could say anything to me and get by with it, and I would take it. And then he would, and he knew he couldn't with her. So he just looked me right in the eye, and he said, no, I never told you I loved you. I love Marie. I said, well, that's all I wanted to know. And so then I told him about that day when he was following me around. He said, well, I had to say that. He said, because I had told her that. I had lied to her. And he said, you understand. And I said, I've quit understanding. I want to understand this. But anyway, this I said that to say this. Men at that time was getting caught in webs. It wasn't because they wanted to. He got caught up in this thing and he couldn't find no way out. And he would have liked to got out. Then he wanted me one day. He run up in the yard with a car and he said, get the children and get in this car. Now this was just before a baby is born. And he said, let's go to Las Vegas. He said, I've got a good job there. Nobody will know where we're at. And he said, we can make this thing. Our divorce wasn't final at this time. And I said, well, I haven't done anything to run from, and I'm not going. But I have often wished that maybe that I had tried that one more time, because that could have been, you know, the time that he would have straightened out. And but I was always afraid of knowing that he was going to have a baby by another woman, that he would always be a sneaking around seeing this child again, which I think that is only normal for a woman to think. And but he, I told him that, and he said, no, I never said I'll never want it. And her husband was coming home from the service. By the way, he was a secret service. He's in the secret service department in the service, and he made tremendous money, and he was sending her money home all this time, and she was supposed to be saving it to buy a home with, and she was blowing it. She blowed every bit of it. Well, his folks wouldn't write and tell him what was going on because they was afraid that he'd get careless and get killed. And so when he got in San Francisco, he called them, and they said to him, well, don't be surprised what you're going to find. We got some things. You come to the house first. So, of course, she'd moved time or two, and he'd had went somewhere to find her. And her and my husband was living together. They weren't married. So when they told him, he just went crazy. And they wouldn't tell him where she was at. So he got a gun, and he was going to kill both of them. So he came to my house, and he came in and talked to me, and I told him, I said, don't do it. I said, I bought a gun to do the same thing. I did buy a gun after that he had beat me and everything, and I was afraid of him. I was afraid to quit him. I was afraid to live with him. So I felt like the only way out was kill him. And he'd pulled a gun on me several times and put a knife to my throat and almost cut my throat. And so I thought, well, the only way out is killing him. You know, I was afraid to leave him. So I bought this gun, a great big thing. I don't even know what it was. And a great big shells in it. And I hid in the hedge where he was at. I found him this night, and he was at her house. And he was sitting in a rocking chair, and she was sitting in his lap, and he's rocking her. Well, the car was sitting in the driveway, and the hedge was about 2 feet. I hid in that hedge, and there was no way I could have missed. I've not been no sharpshooter or anything like that. But I would have just been touching him with a gun. And I fully intended to kill him. This was about 12 o'clock one night. I stayed in that hedge till it was getting daylight and people was going to work. And, of course, when they turned the lights out, I cocked my gun. I was ready. And they went to bed instead of coming out. And that's the only thing saved them. Well, I had to go home. I had a hard chill, and I went to bed, and I shook for about 2 or 3 hours. But you know what? I was glad they didn't come out. But this time, I was thinking right, And I thought, well, he would have been dead. I would go to jail. I'm sure that I would have been acquitted because they had my record of where he'd sent me to the hospital and beaten me and everything. And everybody knew, and everybody would tell me, Lord, I don't, even his friends would tell me, I don't know how you live with him. But anyway, that was just a beginning of the end of him and I. And so I went on my merry way, and I began to work out then. He had told the children they'd starve to death that I didn't know how to work, and he was trying to get them to play on my sympathy. So I said in my heart, I'll make these children a living, and I can say this and say it truthfully. I never drawed one penny of welfare. People all around me, women all around me, was drawing it. I went to work, and I didn't hardly know anything. Well, I didn't know. I'd never worked in a public job. I'd worked in fields, and I could do any of that. I had washed and ironed some for a living. I washed and ironed, starched and ironed clothes for 5 cents each. And if anybody ever hates ironing, I hate ironing. I like to wash, but we was washing on rub board this time. And those old white shirts, I just hated darning them, but I had to. And so then I found me a little cafe job up in East Bakersfield. It's called Railroad Cafe. I believe that's what it's called. I didn't know nothing, how to do anything. And I told them I didn't. And so they told me, you know, and I was so bashful that I could hardly look at anybody. And I was so bashful I couldn't hear them. My ears is the best part about me even yet. But I couldn't even hear them. And I was so bashful. And they'd say, what's your face red about? And I couldn't hardly wait on people. And I stood it 3 days. And then I couldn't stand it any longer. So I quit that job. I didn't know how to make change. And that wasn't because I didn't have a high school education either, because there's a lot of people who have high school education that can't make change. I'll make change with anybody right now, but it was a self-learned thing. I quit that job, and then I went to work at this Chinese cafe. It was called the Mun Yin. It was on 18th with the rest of the restaurants, but it was down there by the canal. A lot of people will remember that. I worked there close to a year, and I loved it. I made $27 a week wages, and my tips run away over that. And so I began to buy new furniture for the house, and I bought clothes for the children. And then on my days off, I would take them to the same place, and we would have dinner at night, and we was really living.
What year would that have been?
That would have been about 43, I believe.
Okay. We're getting close to the end of the
case. Okay.
So let me stop for a second. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay, before you go on any further, I wondered, you and your husband were having a lot of difficulty during that time, and he was physically abusive toward you. I wonder if there were a lot of women that suffered those same kinds of problems during those late 30s, the hard times years.
Yes, there was lots of women that suffered just like I was suffering. Many, many men quit their wives and run off with other women. And I had several neighbors, close neighbors, that this happened to. And to some of them, it just ruined their lives. They didn't have the courage to pick up the pieces and put them back together again. And some of them got married again and married better men than they had.
Must have been a terrifying time for you, though, to think about supporting three children and feeling like you really had nothing and that was a marketable kind of skill.
That's right. I had no skill except working in the field. And I couldn't make a living at that. But I've got to retrace something. This, because this was in 46. It's in the later part of 45 and 46 that this happened.
Okay.
All right. Now, where were we?
You worked a year after.
Yes, I worked about a year there, and with my being unexperienced, I was determined to make a life for my children and I and make a happy life. And I worked at it. I had to work at it. And I know of lots of boys that have been raised with their mother that, they didn't turn out right, because children miss either parent. But I do think they miss a mother more than they do a father. A mother can come near a take in a father's place, and a father can a mother's place. And I proved that to my, not to myself so much, but to my children too. Later they told me they were glad that we had separated, because they had more fun. He was very strict, and then I sage the drunk, and he'd whip them too real hard. I never spared the rod with my children. I raised three good children. I never had, none of my children was ever in trouble, and they're all good citizens today. So I worked there, and then I don't know, remember just what happened. I never got fired, but I taken another job. I think it was a better job. I went to work at the what's the name of that Chinese cafe? Not the rice bowl. Bamboo Chopsticks. I went to work at Bamboo Chopsticks. And I worked there quite a while, and the tips was much more than they were at Munyin. I made really good tips. I made sometimes $100 a week in tips. Now, that isn't anything to some of the waitresses today, but that was good for me. And as I say, we began to do better. I bought a car, and it was a little Essex Terraplane. And I don't even know, guess the make them now, they didn't have the people to know what they were. But that served me well, and we'd take trips when I would be off, me and my children. We'd go to the mountains, and we'd go over to Kern Lake, and we'd just go first one place, another in the park, and we'd have fun. Okay, then I worked at the Rice Bowl. I worked at all those Chinese cafes, and in fact, at that time, they thought I was part Chinese. That Chinese people would even accuse me, because I was real black-headed, and I had a face that looked like I've got a round, fat face, and they all accused me of being Chinese. But anyway, things began to look up for me, and me and my children, we lived alone. And then my oldest daughter got married. She married when she was 14. She was almost 15. I didn't want her to marry. I wanted her to go ahead and finish school, but she told me, she said, Mama, if you don't let me marry, I'll run off. I said, well, I'll never sign for you. And her boyfriend did run off and go to Las Vegas, and they called me and wanted me to tell a story and say that she was 16 and I wouldn't do it, and they had to come home. And she wouldn't hardly speak to me for a day or two, but later then, let's see, I had went somewhere, and she got my sister to sign an affidavit and sign it and sign my name to it, and so they did get married. But, you know, I've never been sorry, because she could have had a search warrant out for the best man in the world, and she could have never found any better. He was, he was about 8 years older than her, or 11, 8, I guess, or 9, something like that. And they have never separated. She never had children until they'd been married about 13 years. And they finally thought they'd never have children. They finally had a little boy, and then about 2 years, and then they had a little girl. They've never had any more. And she's got the best man in the world. They've never been separated. He's so good to her. And I think as much of that son-in-law as I could ever think of any of my children. In fact, he's just my child, that's all, because he married her so young and come into our family, and he's never said a cross word to me in his life. And I love that old boy. Okay, now where am I?
Okay, you were talking about your youngest daughter got, or your oldest daughter got married.
Okay. I went from different cafes, and that was my line of work, was cafe work. I worked at French's Cafe in Bakersfield, and then it was not hard for me to get a job. But this time I had self-confidence. I was that kind of a person that once I got self-confidence, nothing could stop me. So I didn't back down from anything. I went into the best cafes and worked. And I worked in some little cafes in Lamont. I worked in the Dewdrop Inn, and it was a cafe. That building right by the theater was a big cafe at that time, and I worked there for a long time. But anyway, my oldest girl was married, and of course she moved out. And then later on, my youngest daughter went to Bible school, Gilroy Bible School. I can't even remember what year that was. But then that left me and my boy. We went to Colorado. He's getting up big enough. When school was out, we went to Colorado. And I got a job working at a hot springs. And the spring was about 300 or 400 yards back in the ground. And the house kind of set over it, and you'd come up and part of the house, and you'd go down some steps, and you'd go way, way back and under this, and it was hot springs, and it was an old thing that the Indians had had years and years ago, because they still had some of their pottery in there, and this spring just bubbled up out of the ground, and then it run out a hole way back over the other way, and they had holes dug down in there, and pure rock, and that was where they bathed, and it was real sulfur. And then there was a place that came up out of this rock, and they drank this. And so people would come there and take baths from all over, and some would camp. It was like a park. And they would camp, and they would take these baths and drink this water for their arthritis. And believe me, it cured it. My daddy come out there, and he was crippled up that he could hardly get up and down these steps, but before he left, he was running up and down them, and he was, at this time, he was in his late 60s. So we stayed there, and we taken a liking to it. The big San Miguel River run right the edge of the park, and my boy done lots of fishing, and he's a fisherman. And so then that year when my daughter got out of Bible school, she came and stayed with us, and so then we was there. I guess for a year or so. Then we came back to Lamont. That was where our home was. We owned a home, and so we would always come back there from time to time. But then we made other trips to Colorado until the time that my boy was grown, and then he went into the service. And he went into the service in 57, I believe it was. And I run across a wonderful man in 58. And, well, I guess I run across him in 57, but I didn't marry him for 6 months after. And by this time, I was working in the Padre Hotel. Am I supposed to go into these years?
Just a little. I would just like to know what happened after the...
Okay. I remarried. I married a wonderful man. And I sold my place at Lamont, and I began to buy a property. And I was quite an adventurous, so I bought property in Colorado Springs. I sold that. I bought property at Cortez, Colorado. I sold that. And everywhere I went, I bought a piece of property and sold. And I always made a little money on it. I was quite a real estate lady. And if I had been really educated where I could have got my real estate license, I could have been a millionaire today. I really know that. I know that. I'm just as confident of that. Yes, sir. And I could always look at a piece of property, and I would know what would go good there. And I'd tell my husband, let's buy that. This would be a good place. Oh, you're always, you know. And sure enough, somebody would buy that and put that very same thing in. And he'd say, well, how'd you know that? But this was just a gift that I had. And I'd always tell him, if he'd go along with me, we'd be millionaires. I bought on... Oswell, I bought at Fairfax, I bought Valencia,
I've bought all over. So I've got a place in Utah. I finally got to Utah, and I've got a little place. It's my summer home, and I come here in the winter. I winter here and summer in Utah, and I enjoy it very much. We have livestock there and milk cow, and I have somebody taking care of it when I'm gone in the winter. And chickens and hogs, and we kill our own meat and do whatever what that we need to do.
Oh, what year did your second husband?
He died in 76. My father had went to Arkansas to live a while, and he got sick. He had leukemia. He was 95, and I took a van and I went and I got my father and brought him back out here. He called me one day and he said, "Sister, there's something real bad wrong with me, and I need you to come." And I come, and so he wanted to go back. Well, I flew back. I called my nephew, and he brought a van, and we brought my daddy out. My daddy died in my house at Fairfax in 74. The day my daddy died, my husband had gone to the hospital for some prostate gland test, and the day my daddy died, they told me my husband had cancer. Okay, I'd had my daddy for, a couple of months there, taking care of him. Well, I went right back in under that then, after we got my daddy put away, and I was under this for 2.5 more years, and my husband died in September the 27th, 1976. And so I've been roaming around since then.
Wow, good for you. So you took care of your mom until she died.
I did.
You took care of your dad.
I did.
One time you mentioned that your father's dream was to own property here in California, own a farm.
Yes.
In California. Did he ever see that dream?
He never did own a farm, but he worked for many people, and he was loved. Everybody that my father ever worked for wanted him. And they, when they would take trips and they had stock and stuff, they always come and got my daddy, and he would stay for a week or two at a time after my mother died. And of course, he worked in the fence too, and he was getting quite old at that time, and he worked at Lump Oak, and they built army houses and all kinds of housing and things. But I moved from Fairfax after I had lost two loved ones in that house. But I went into county nursing in between times, and I should have been a nurse, too. That's what I intended to do if I'd have finished school. I fully intended to be a nurse. That was my heart's desire, is to be a nurse. Well, I went to nursing, and I learned how to give shots with my mother. And there at the last, there was close to 6 months, I had to give her a shot every hour on the hour. And I was trying to take care of my family. This was at the time my husband and I drifted apart. And probably some of this could stem from this. I was having to spend so much time, and I was just like a walking zombie. Mm-hmm. I'd get up from my place and have to go down there and give her a shout out. In the morning, get home, I'd have to go back.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'd fall asleep, and I'd hear her screaming. And I'd just have to go. So it got to where I was having to spend the night. And I could get up and mix her morphine and give her a shot and never know I'd give it.
Hmm.
I never did give her an overdose.
Mm-hmm.
And so then my daddy, I had to give him shots. And then my husband, I had to give him shots.
Wow.
And I was up day and night with him giving him shots. And other people, they have sent for me to come and give shots when they would have to. And I can give shots as good as anybody. And so I should have been a nurse.
You should drop your name off with some home health agency or something. There might be a call for somebody.
They have tried to get me to.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. They have really tried to get me to. But you know what? I love to go so much, and I just hate to tie myself down.
Right.
I drive. I bought my little car in the latter part of 78. I've got 34,539 miles on it.
You're a goer,
huh? And I love to go. I love to travel. I love scenery. And I don't care about traveling with people. Now, that is strange. If if I find somebody like me that likes the same things I do, I do. But other words, I like to go for myself because other people don't enjoy the things I do. I enjoy God's creation. And I do lots of missionary work. I never did get that in. I work with the American Indians, and I've been going off and on for years. I don't stay. I go. I have built several missions with my own hands. And I teach the Word of God. I also teach cleanliness and health. And I usually always take lots of different things with me, like, what is this stuff they call it, this purple stuff for infantigo? They have it. I'll tell you, they have it there. And Indians are ate up with that. And I take that, and I take bandages and Mercurochrome and all kinds of disinfect and stuff to clean their sores, and I've taken care of little children that was covered all over.
Go to one particular reservation, or you go to a whole bunch of...
Well, I go to different ones, but I especially work in the Four Corner area, that is over where Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah meets, where you can send in all four states at once.
Before you go on, I want to backtrack and ask you a couple of really specific questions that go back to the 1930s time. When you were working in the field, or when your husband was still in the field, do you recall any efforts to organize the field workers?
I remember them talking about it. And it was like people would meet in different people's yards. Then we just, there was no fences or anything. We just all like one big family. And we'd just see somebody walk over somebody's yard where it's over with just a whole bunch of us over there. And I remember this being talked. And I remember also that some of them was for it, and then some of them was afraid. They had had such a hard time, they was afraid that if anything would try to be organized, that maybe they would get fired and they wouldn't have work. But I remember my husband saying, "Say, this is what we need. We need protection, and we need to where that a farmer won't have it all on his side, that they can't just make us do, you know." And I remember it being talked, but I was out of the field before it really happened.
And I would imagine then the same thing is true for strikes. Did you... Were you pretty much out of the fields by the time that there were any?
I was, now I cut grapes too, and I worked at DiGiorgio. I packed. The first year we came out here, it was the second year. Anyway, I packed. My baby was tiny. I guess it was the first year that we came, yes. I packed fruit at DiGiorgio. And then in later years, after we'd bought at Lamont and moved, my husband and I separated, I worked in the restaurant there, and then I cut grapes. I worked in the fields, too. And before it was over, I know I was working some in the field off and on after they began to strike, but I was never in a strike. I quit one time because I'd heard that they were going to strike. And my daddy was afraid that I would get hurt. And he said, "Now, sister," he said, "somebody's going to get hurt." And he said, "You've got these children to take care of." And he said, "You can always find another job." He said, "You've always been lucky that way." He said, "Why don't you quit?" And I was ready to quit anyhow. It was hot. And they did strike, and there was people got hurt. They got beat up. In fact, I think somebody got killed before it was over. Mm-hmm.
So actually, you kind of worked on and off in the fields, but after your like the 40s, the early 40s, you were just there every now and again.
Just in between times.
Uh-huh. Okay. The other question that I wanted to back way up and talk about: did your dad ever talk about any of the government policies that were either harmful or helpful to the Oklahoma farmers during those rough years there?
Yes, we were kind of naive at that time, you know, and I remember Roosevelt, I believe it was Roosevelt, and when we was having such a hard time, and he brought this program in that they would buy part of your crop and plow it up, you know. And because there was such overproductive, I guess, everything was so cheap, they were trying to get the prices up. And then they would buy your cow. They would go through the cows, and they would check out the cows that didn't look too healthy, and they would test them, too. And then they would pay you so much for that cow, they'd kill that cow. And then if there wasn't anything wrong with them, they'd just pay you for the cow, and they'd kill it, and they'd take it in. And they had these cameras, and they, if it was a good cow, and here's where they began to appropriate this food for the welfare program. And then they would, you could sign up, you could get canned meat. In fact, we got a, I did, my folks didn't. I got a few of it when my husband had left and went to Arizona to work. I went in and I signed up and I got some canned stuff and got some peanut butter and applesauce and just a few little things they gave. But anyway, this really helped. But I remember my father and my mother talking this over, and they said they thought the end of time was coming. They was great Bible readers. And they had read, you know, about different things. And my daddy really thought this was leading up to the end time. And they didn't know where to do it or not. But they talked it over, and daddy said, well, what's going to happen will happen. And he said, so we'll just go ahead and do it. But he said, that old president has really got it worked out. And he knows what he's doing. And he said, he's... they didn't think it was going to be for the good of the people. But my daddy said, I need the money. And I'll do it. And so there was lots of people against it. Some of them wouldn't do it for a long time. In fact, we didn't. And so, but then it did. It worked out for the best. It was good for us. And because it put meat in the canneries for people to eat that didn't have anything. And then it also gave you some money to get by on. And it did keep the price of crops level. And so, yes, there was a lot of apprehension in those days of everything.
Well, the other question that I was curious about is, I think you partially answered it, but I wanted to just double check, as far as during those 30 years, like you came in 36, so in 37, 38, 39, those were really, really super difficult years. Were you and your husband, or did anyone in your family ever have to accept any outside help, or were you able to make your checks stretch far enough to get through those years?
Well, as I say, my husband got on WPA. There was another program that I think my daddy got on just for a short while, but he was just like I always was. He didn't believe in taking anything unless you had to have it. And I remember he signed up for something, and he didn't work for it. It was like maybe some food or something, or a small check, because, see, my mother was dying with cancer, and he couldn't leave her all the time. And so they got this. But then right after that, my brothers went into the service, and they made them allotments.
Oh.
And so they got by on that. But, I guess my husband, and he worked for what he got. He was on WPA. But my daddy was never for taking anything that he didn't have to have. And as I say, he was a good manager. He could always find something. And so did my husband.
Okay, we're coming to the end of the tape. And we're... This is the second tape of the second session with Loy Holmes. Okay, another thing that I wanted to ask you about was in those 30 years when you first came to California, what kind of reception did you get from the Californians? Did you ever feel that the people The local people were unfriendly, or were they fairly friendly? What was it like?
No, they weren't friendly. There was a few that had a heart in them. I remember when I spoke back earlier that I went to work with these people in Bakersfield, and right after we'd first got out here, and I worked 3 weeks. I knew more about babies than she ever thought about, because I had helped raise some of my mother's, and then I'd had these two of my own. And they went somewhere this night, and they left me with this baby, and it cried and cried, and I was taking care of the baby, and I knew it was constipated. And I used a suppository to move its bowels. And when she came in and I told her what I'd done, I thought she'd be glad that baby had cried and his tummy was so hard. She got mad at me, and she went and called her doctor, and it was about 12 o'clock at night, and she called her doctor, and she said, "This dumb Okie." I sat there and I looked at her till she got off of the phone, and I told her, I said, "I may be a dumb Okie, but I said, I know how to take care of children." And I said, "What did your doctor say?" "Well," she said, "strangely enough, he said that you done the right thing." I said, "Well, I'll tell you something else while we're at it. You get you another girl, because I won't be here any longer than daylight, and I can get somebody here to get me." And she said, "Oh, you can't do that." I said, "Hide and watch." And I did. I left. And so, and she bagged me, and she told me she was sorry and everything, but I was independent too. And we had fights. I had fights. I had 2 or 3 fights over people slurring me about being an Okie. And boy, that was what the most of people's fights was over when we first came here, was criticism. They'd call us, you know, all kinds of things. And boy, I'm telling you, they can say what they want to, but those men that came from those states, they didn't take no guff off of nobody. And they just knocked them over if they...
Tell me about the disagreements that you had, the fights that you had over being called...
Well,
Okay.
There was one lady that I went to her house for something, I don't recall. Oh, it's about my children, I guess. And her children was criticizing my children and said that that their mother, the children was okay, but said their mother didn't want them to play with my children because we was Okies and we might have some kind of disease and we might have lice. And, you know, that's how those tales all got started. And my children come home, and I said, "I thought you was going to play with them, those children." And it was hardly ever I'd let my children go off like that, but it was just a couple of houses up. So they come home, and I said, "What happened?" I seen that woman out there in the yard, and they said, "That woman told us to go home, that so-and-so couldn't play with us, that we was Okies, and that we might have lice." I never knew when I hit that ground. I was over there in that woman's house. I never knocked on no door. I jerked her door open, and I guess she probably thought I was stupid the time that was over. And she was in the kitchen, and I flew in there, and I grabbed her by the dress, and I told her, I said, "If you ever call my children an Okie again," I said, "They are. They're Okies. We're good Okies." But I said, "You don't have enough sense." I said, "If you had a brain, it'd rattle." And I said, "You don't have enough sense to go in out of the rain." And I said, "You have humiliated my children. I don't care what you say to me. If you think you can get by with it," I said, "you call me one right now." She began to back off, and she said, "I'm sorry, I don't know, you know." I slapped her right upside the head. I slapped her so hard. And so my husband told me, he said, "They'll have you arrested." I said, "I don't care. I'd be worth going to jail for." And I left. That woman, she couldn't be friendly enough with me.
Hmm.
That's the truth. She couldn't be friendly enough with me. And then again, I was in town. I was on the streets of Bakersfield. And you know how when you're
moving around, and you step on somebody's heel.
Mm-hmm.
And I stepped on her heel, and she turned around, and I said, "Oh, excuse me." I said, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that." She could tell by my voice that I, where I was from. And she said, "Well, you could expect anything out of an Okie." And I had her before I knew it, too. I had her by the arm. And I just pointed my finger right in her face, and I said, "Okie or no Okie." I said, "You just say anything out of the way to me again, and I said, I'll knock your head off." And I've never been a fighter. I've never been. But it was like something in us that we expected, see, people to look down on us because we'd heard so many tales and things. And it was like you was on the defensive side. And the men was the same way. But, you know, it wasn't very long after that. Really, I got feeling sorry for these people. I really did, because I found out that I had more principle, more love, and more everything than they ever thought about having. And I really felt sorry for them. And then when something would come up, that's what I'd tell them. And I just turned my tactic on them, or what's called technique. And I'd tell them, you know, when they'd say something, I'd say, "You know what, I feel sorry for you." Well, I'll tell you what I told one of them one time. She said that she couldn't understand me because I was okay the way I talked. I said, "Well, you know, that's strange. You're supposed to be smart." I said, "I'm smarter than you. I can understand you, and I can understand Okie language, too." And I said, "You can only understand the way you talk." So I said, "Who's the smart one?" So anyway, that's just, you know, neither here nor there. But
when do you think that started subsiding, that really anti-Oklahoman feeling?
I think after the war. When our boys, the Okies and the Arkies and Texas and Missouri and all, went to the war and fought and helped win the war, we become equal. It was like, you know, we just become equal. And it seemed like, I know some of the people that I knew, their boys went, you know, and then they would meet you and they'd say, "Well, have you heard from your brothers? Have you heard?" And, "Well, I haven't heard from my boy." And it was like we was all on common ground. And the war broke down a lot of things. And some of them was never that way after that they come home, you know, the boys come home. And it also done something for the boys that felt like that they was raised here and that they was uppity up, you know. When they was over there, there was no room for being stuck up and "I'm better than you." Why, they had just as leave for an Okie to save their life as they would of their own brother.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, you know. And so that just put us all on common grounds, I think, and it began to subside.
What did you ever read or hear about the Grapes of Wrath, the novel that John
Yes. Wrote? I read that, and I was real aware of right where it's taking place. A lot of it was filmed. It was at Weed Patch, just right up for a mile from me. And I have been there. I've been on that slab, that big cement slab where they was dancing and everything. I've been right on that. I've been there to a dance.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of the story of that? How true was that in terms of the way the people had to live at that point?
Well, I'll tell you, the most of it was true. The most of it was true. There was a government camp there, or I think it was a government camp, wasn't it? I know there's lots of little places there for people to live. And we never lived there. We never lived in a government camp. I was real fortunate, you know. But we used to go over there and visit around, and we'd drive through. And then the church that I went to, they went out there and held services, and I went out with them. And it was terrible. There's no way to describe. The year that we came to Lamont, there was a canal. Not a canal, just a water ditch that ran up
right by the road, and there was trees all up through there. And I'll tell you how bad it was. There's people that never even had a tent. And they was camped all along that ditch bank, and they would have up a blanket pinned on the trees, and maybe pinned on the trees, and then some poles up. And I'm telling you, there would be from 20 to 30 lined up and down them trees, a living like this. And I remember we would come down through there, and I would just cry, because I hadn't had to really live like that. And we camped out coming, you know, mm-hmm. But seemed like the Lord was good to us. My folks was Christians, and I become a Christian when I was 19, and it just seemed like the Lord cared for his own. And we was always able to find a place to live. Maybe for a little while we would be, you know, be hard up, but we usually always just snapped right out of it. Mm-hmm. And you know what amazes me is that people can say what they want to, but most of the people that came from Oklahoma, they have retired well off. And that shows they weren't lazy. See, the thing that usually they thought about the most was, because we came out here, they thought we was lazy and was coming for a handout. But there was no harder workers than the Oklahoma people and Arkansas people. They didn't back off from anything. They knowed what hard work was. Many of them cut fence posts for a living. In fact, my husband done that over in the lake bottom. And so we was accused of just coming to California because we didn't want to work, but that wasn't it. I wish some of these people could have been tucked right back and put in our shoes. They'd have died. They'd starve to death. There's no way they could have even survived. But anyway, we've seen this. We've seen people are living under sheets. We've seen women that were so big and pregnant. We've seen them with little babies. We've seen little children playing on that ditch bank. And sometimes we would stop. My mother and father both was great talkers. And we would stop and visit with them. And I don't know. We never was that poor. Never was. Mm-hmm. And so...
Well, you came out here with a goodly amount of money in comparison to many people that I've talked with had 30 and got to the state with $5 in their
hands. Uh-huh. Yes, I guess we were called rich Okies. I don't know, but that's something I think. I just thank the Lord that we didn't have to go through. And it was bad sometimes with us, you know, mm-hmm. real bad. But I've seen worse times back there than I ever seen here.
Back there, meaning Oklahoma.
Yes, as I told you back in the tape, how that one time we had nothing but cornbread and just whey milk. Not mm-hmm. the milk, mm-hmm. the whey that came off of it. If you know what that is, that's after it clabbers and that water rises to the top. And I seen some hard times back there, but we finally got on our feet, and there was times that we never had a lot, but my mother would always, she'd say, well, you kids need some new shoes or something. And she'd say, go catch some chickens. And we'd get out there and run them chickens all over the farm and put them in a gunny sack. And here we'd go to town, and sometimes we'd ride horses. And I was a great horse rider in that time. I'd go to pie suppers, and I thought nothing about going out and catching my horse and throwing the saddle on it and cinching it up And I couldn't do this now, and there aren't very many men could do that. I could take a pie, an open-faced pie, you know, a salt pie like a coconut. I could hold that pie and get on my horse and tear that pie as much as 6 and 7 miles, and it wouldn't even be shook up.
Oh, you must have been quite out.
Yeah. I never used a saddle half the time. I'd just run and grab my horse and jump up on it, and I'd go get the cows, and we'd go down the fields, and if we missed a cow that was going to have a baby, well, we'd have to look her up, you know.
That was in Oklahoma.
That was in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not here. I've not had no horse here. I wish I did. Oh, Got a couple. Got a mule. Got a mule out in Utah and a horse that I haven't had her very long, but a sale, and she's way back. I don't know. Wouldn't need saddle for her.
Okay.
But anyway.
Did you get the sense that what it was like for the people living in the government camps? How were they? Were they pretty happy with that, or did that seem like?
Some of them were, and some of them wasn't. I remember lots of people saying, "I wish I was back home. Mm-hmm. I had more back home," because it looked like they could never get on their feet, you know. And they'd say, "At least we had a house, and we had milk and butter and some eggs and things like that." But the thing of it is, things were burning up, and they heard that there was plenty of work in California and plenty to eat, and you'll do anything. So they just came, but most of those people, there was some that went back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all of my folks that stayed in Oklahoma, they could buy me and sell me a dozen times.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And most of the rest of us. But all of my family has retired with homes and everything. And so they haven't done too bad for themselves. And they learned trade, my brothers. I've got one brother that's a minister. And my other brother lives out here. He's a retired carpenter and a veteran. And my other brother retired from a big engineering company. And I only have one brother, and he's in Arkansas. And he came out here and stayed for a while, but he hated every minute of it. And he made tremendous money here. He was what they call a cat skinner. And they paid good money for that. And he could make money and just roll in money. But he never loved one minute of it. And he left his wife and family and went back. And she liked it better here because she had more and had a different life. And they divorced, and he married again, and he's still in Arkansas. And he loves it, and he hates to even come out here and visit. He's getting too old to come out here and visit now. But
so it sounds like all of your family did quite well.
We done quite well. I haven't
mentioned that your son is a minister.
My son is a minister, and he lives in Utah, just right over the line from Colorado.
Is that how you got?
No, I was there a long time before he ever was. We went to St. George, Utah, in somewhere in the early 40s, somewhere in there for a while, and we done missionary work. I taken on myself. I always loved Indians. And I didn't know they had an Indian reservation there, but we went out there and we was settled there just for a while, and I seen these Indians all up in town. And we was staying in a hotel at this time.
Who is we?
My son.
Oh.
And so I stopped one of them and talked to him one day, and I said, "Is there a reservation here close?" And he said, "Yes. The Shifwit and the reservation is 14 miles up." And I said, "Do you have any church or minister or anything out there?" And they said, "No." And I said, "Would you like to?" And they said, "Yeah, that's where they talk to you." And so I made arrangements, and I went out one day, and I took a lot of live tour, and I went, and I just went around all over the place, and I distributed. And so then the last place I went to, I was in this house, and I was talking to them. Some of them could talk English, and some of them couldn't, because some of them had been away to government schools. You know, they do that now.
Mm-hmm.
And so directly, this great big Indian walked out of this back room, and he said, "What you want?" And it scared me dead, you know. And I said, "Well, I'm a missionary." And I said, "I would like to know if you would like to have some services." And I said, "And if you do, where could we have them?" I was talking real fast, and he said, "Right here." I said, "Right here?" He said, "I'm chief of this tribe." And I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "Yeah." So we had a good talk, and so I made arrangements, and my brother, my brother was there with me, that's right, and he went with me, that's who was with me, and my son. So I went home and told my brother, and so we went out on a Wednesday night, and we had services, and we seen every one of those Indians on that reservation come to the Lord, except the Lord. And we had a church out there, and so then from there is where I started working with the Indians. And every time I'd go to Colorado, I'd go to, out somewhere on a reservation, and I didn't have to know where I was going. I'd just like be driving along the road. I'd see a hogan out, and I'd just turn off, and I got to where I was taking just big gobs of clothes, and I would clothe the children, and I'd just give to them, you know. And so then in Cortez, I started an Indian mission. I bought an old house, and it had one huge room to it. And nobody had lived in that house for years, and this drunk Indians and Mexicans slept in it. And I bought it for practically nothing, and I converted this one great big room into a mission, and I put me up a sign and run an ad in the paper, and I began to have more people than I could get in there. And then I was going home in the winter of 69 in November, and I had a real bad accident in Kingman, Arizona, and was everything but killed. My friend was driving, and she ran a stop, and a truck hit us in the side, and she was on her way to the hospital with her baby, and we didn't know each other, and it had 104 temperature, and she was driving 65 miles an hour, and she hit on my side, and I was in the hospital for days there, and I didn't know anything, and I had to give that mission up. But then as soon as I recuperated, I began to go back. Until even last year, I was there, and I ministered to them, and I write them, and they give me Indian jewelry and make me things, and I give them things, and so we just have real good fellowship.
Oh, sounds like it.
I love
two
it.
Two daughters, like one daughter lives here in Bakersfield, and your other daughter also.
She lives in Aurora Grande on the coast, and my other boy is in Monticello, Utah. And he's minister. All of my children are Christians. All my grandchildren is Christians.
Yeah.
And so it pays off.
Yeah. One final question. When you look back over the whole experience of coming to California and living through those years of being a migrant and all of the hard times, do you think that affected you in the long run as the kind of person you are?
I do. I wouldn't want to go back over it. But I wouldn't take anything for not even one experience. Some people grew bitter and got worse, you know, fell apart at the seams. But I said, when I come to California, I have never seen a time that I wanted to retract and go back to Oklahoma. Never have I. When I shucked the dust off of my feet in Oklahoma, I've never wanted to go back and live. I hardly ever wanted to go back and visit, and I haven't very few times. And that was just going through. I stopped and seen some of my kin folks, not on my side, but on my husband's side. But I said to myself, after a few run-ins, like I said, Ben and Oki, that my experiences was going to sweeten me instead of becoming bitter. And I have worked toward that. And I have taken advantage of every opportunity that I find to make myself a better person and to learn and to grow. And I'm still doing it.
So the experiences that you had back then, you think, caused you to grow and become a more positive? Is that
yes, positive. I was very shy and not self-sufficient. What do you call it? There's another word for it.
Lacking in confidence.
Lacking in confidence. The worst in the world. And I had an inferior complex. Bad.
Mm-hmm.
I had freckles. I was black-headed, blue eyes with great big freckles. And you don't see too many now, but my face was freckled. And I've got pictures where I had great big freckles. And this, I had a complex over this, and people would call me Freck. I had more fights in school over people calling me Freck. So it gave me a complex, and I remember one time when I was a child, and I was we'd been to church, and my mother was standing talking to this lady, and I was hanging on to her hand looking up. I was about 7 at this time. And she looked at me, and my freckles were so brown, and I was so black-headed and blue-eyed. She said, my mother's name was Charlie.
Charlie,
and my daddy's name was Willie and Charlie. And she looked at my mother, and she says, Charlie, I believe that child has a disease. I've never seen a child with freckles like that. She ain't supposed to have freckles. She's black-headed. But see, I got the hair after my mother. She's half Cherokee in it. My mother said, oh, my Jernigan, is that all the sense that you have? This child don't have no disease. That's freckles. What's wrong with you? That woman wound up being my sister-in-law. She wound up being my sister-in-law. But anyway, I came out here with a real bad complex, and I would walk with my arms behind me, and I never would wear short sleeves. And as my confidence built, and I learned that I was just me, and I went to a doctor one time. I was so self-conscious about this, I made an appointment and went to a doctor, a medical doctor. Believe it or not, I didn't know they had skin doctors, you know. And so he set me down. He said, what are you in here for? And I told him, he said, young lady, sit down there. I won't talk to you. And he said to me, he said, if you wanted to bad enough, you can use stuff and get rid of freckles. But he said, there isn't everybody can have freckles. There's a lot of people would like to have freckles. And he said, you just count yourself lucky you've got them, and you just go ahead and be you. And don't let this bother you. You're a pretty girl. You've got a good personality. And you know, that man, I wish I knew where he was at. I would look him up and kiss him. That done more for me. And I began to say, well, Lord, you're just you, freckles and all. And you know, I got to where that didn't hurt me. And when I did, I didn't think anything about it. Nobody else did. I was my own worst enemy, see?
Okay. All right, we're just about at the end of this tape, so why don't we just stop there?
All right.